public enterprises, because National Treasury will transfer these amounts to the Department of Public Enterprises, and from there it will be transferred to ESCOM to cover their debt costs. So this is just the bottom line is showing that the department is going to spend $43 billion and $33 billion in the two financial years, and you can see it's a huge, it will make a huge difference on the budget of DPE. And the question then will be is, will DPE be able to basically monitor this high amount of expenditure? And it's a huge responsibility to do oversight over these huge amounts. So the question is, will they have the capacity in the department to do this oversight over, because they will transfer it from their side. The other consideration for the committee might be, normally these transfers are made from payments for financial assets. But if you pay it from financial assets, you don't really have a track record over time to whom these payments are made. So it's much better to show it in your account, in your accounts as a transfer, because in the bookkeeping on the database, they provide for specific entities. So in 10 years' time, when the committee goes back and try and figure out how many what government has paid over to ESCOM, it will be easier to track in the future. In terms of the bill, there were a few conditions in the bill, presented in the bill, but it's basically the Minister of Finance may impose conditions to ESCOM. The Minister must impose conditions to be met by ESCOM after the transfer of part of the money, and the Minister of Finance must stop the use of any part of the amount in respect of which conditions have been imposed in terms of subparagraph 2 until such conditions are met. But those conditions have not been set already, so we're still waiting on the conditions. In one of our previous meetings, the National Treasury provided us some of the draft conditions that they might impose on ESCOM. The National Treasury must also disclose the stoppage of an allocation in the next quarterly report to the Committee of Finance on the National Assembly and the National Council of the Provinces. So if any payments are stopped, then they must report to this committee and or to the Committees of Finance in both houses. And any part of the amount of the transfer to ESCOM by the end of the financial year that has not been used must be paid back to the provincial the National Revenue Fund. Just in terms of further conditions, we are saying that this committee can develop conditions for the Minister of Finance as well as public enterprises, and they can also develop conditions for ESCOM in terms of this additional appropriation. But the Minister of Finance must impose conditions for the Department of Public Enterprises in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, the mandate of the department, as well as the purpose of the program from where DPE will transfer this money to ESCOM. The conditions from the Minister of Finance to DPE must actually be done because they transfer the money to DPME. They don't transfer the money directly to ESCOM. It goes via DPE. And then the Minister of Public Enterprises must impose conditions to be met by ESCOM in terms of the transfer that they're going to make, and in terms of the structure and the whole restructuring process of ESCOM, as well as the supply chain management regulations. My colleague will continue with the presentation in terms of the financial position of ESCOM.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honourable members. Good morning, colleagues. Thank you. I'll just continue from there. My name is Tim Sani, as Nelia has introduced me. Thanks, Nelia. Chair, I thought what we do as well, we would provide committee with an financial analysis of the ESCOM financial position and performance as at 31st March earlier this year. based on the financial statements that were produced, and we'll also provide some comparative figures there. You know, and as you can see there, what we've seen in the financials, the assets, Eskom assets have increased quite a bit. When you look at, there has been some additions over the past 3 years. I think in 2018, we've seen new plants being completed, some section of some of plants being completed, which has increased the valuation of assets in Eskom, which is a very positive story to give, you know, to give some relief on the gearing of the entity. But also, however, we've seen current assets has been declining over time, which of course talks to the issue of the entity not having enough cash or enough cash to deal with some of the operations. But I think what we want to highlight, Chair, is the way, I mean, it was discussed yesterday with the National Treasury, the way the debt has increased over time. And clearly between 2017 and 2018, we've seen an increase by almost more than 100 billion of debt securities and borrowing over time. And of course, this increase, it does indicate the increase of interest payments and over time. I think one of the reasons why we're trying to show these analysis, the Chair and other members, that of course we want also all of us to get to the grip where we are and what some of the challenges that the entity, which leads some of the needs of bailouts and some of the core fundamental issues at the entity, which we'll highlight also in going forward there. Zooming quite to debt, as I was saying, you realize that I think your printouts are not as colorful as my presentation. I do apologize for that. But we just want to emphasize there that over the past 5 years, we've seen debt increasing quite rapidly, you know, from 250 billion going up to 450 billion. But I think what we want to highlight there as well, it's showing that over the past 2-3 years, we've seen short-term debt also escalating quite a bit with the green bar there, you know, which certainly it means there's a lot of pressure in the entity's ability to meet its operations commitments, and hence the short-term debt has been used in this regard. And that does put more pressure because short-term debt at times more expensive compared to longer-term debt, but also allows entity space to breathe in this regard. But that's a bit of worry there when you look at that green bar there. Of course, I'm just trying to run through some of these things. Coming back to financial performance, based on the financial statements and that was audited, Eskom seen a decline in the profitability compared to the previous year. Earnings from operation has declined by 31% compared to 2018. And but obviously, some of the key issues there, you realize that over time, Eskom has the sales volume of electricity has been declining over the years, meaning the number of the quantity of electricity sold has been declining over years, and of course that could be another contributing factor in terms of stability for the entity to generate more income or revenue, but also the demand, which could also indicate demand might have went down than expected. On average, 0.4% has been a decline in volume, sales volume over the years. But I think 2019 has seen a higher steep in 1.8% decline in the Eskom electricity sales volume there. But of course, despite the decline in the sales volume, we've seen the sales value has increased by 3% compared to the previous year. But of course, one of the points that has, I think, it was touched on yesterday. It was not discussed quite substantively. But when we look at financial statements, some of the concerns from the governing structures and so on is that the tariffs approvals, increased approvals by NERSA have not been reflective of some of the costs that are incurred by entity for overtime, and that is why the entity has not been able to realize more income in this regard. But when you look at some of the findings or the concerns from the auditors, has been that the entity has not been able to produce a proper mechanism to ensure that it collects enough money that it creates as a result of not being able to collect enough money. It's been a standing concern over the years, I think 3 years now, that the auditors say, no, Eskom doesn't have proper steps and mechanism to raise revenue that or to collect revenue that it needs to collect. And I think the other point which has been labored on a lot is the receivables as well. Municipalities have been weighing heavily on the entity's ability to generate enough cash for operations. And seeing the increase in the debtors from last year by 13% compared to the prior year, and there has been also some of the consumers who are not using electricity, but they are not willing to pay. I think, as the example, in the financial uses, the Soweto, as well as the Soweto residents, some of the big area there, and where consumers are not meeting their commitment. But also, over and above that, there has been loss in electricity, of almost 2 billion from either tempering of the meters or from other mechanisms which would have meant more revenue for the entity thereof. Next slide. Just quickly running through this. Coming back on expenditure, I think the first slide was largely on the revenue side. Coming back to expenditure, which is we've seen that overall production volume has declined, as I said earlier on, and that would have meant that the sales volume has declined. That would have meant that the production as well would have declined, as shown in the financials there. But of course, as we know, Eskom has different generation sources, and IPP is also has been highlighted in the financials as the contributing factors. Some of the costs are quite higher there, over and above what the other, over and above its contribution to the sources of electricity, and that shift, it has improved a bit from prior year. But of course, in a nutshell, the production, there has been a significant increase in the primary costs since 2018. Own generation costs have increased by 18%, 15% from last year, and IPPs by 29%. And of course, there has been also unplanned planned maintenance of coal fired plants. And I think the point about the slides, largely, Chair and Honourable Members, just to emphasise that what we see when we read the financials and some of the information, the main challenge here is largely around the costs. How does the entity, able to manage the costs in given all the issues that are surrounding there? That's the main issue. I think the slide was meant to highlight that in a sense. But also, more so seeing that the revenue, there isn't much bigger room for revenue to increase beyond, certain levels. And clearly, you'll see now later that the cost, the production, particularly the production costs, are a bit quite steeper. I mean, we had discussions today where there's been an increase in coal beyond expectations, or whether there's available money for that. That builds up to a discussion where there's certainly a bigger issues around production or around costs in the entity thereof. One other aspect also is the employee benefits. We've seen increase by 13%, which is largely really, I need to clarify this because I think previously there was not, I think the increase in employee benefits is largely because of the pension fund benefits, which amounted to 1.1 billion. Because according to the financials, salary increase was amount to 7%, really. It's not really the whole expenditure. Increase was for salary increases thereof. Also, some of the concerns from the auditors as well, again, lack of effective steps to deal with some irregularities, I think it's also a big issue, which I think Eskom has highlighted that as well. And issues around management of the contracts, procurement contracts, has also been highlighted some of the challenges the entity is you know, is in, advice to address in this regard. And as the debt increases, we would automatically expect the cost of debt also to increase, and that's been reflected in financials as well. We've seen the finance costs increase by 16%, and I think the issue is the two bullets that follows after that. We talked about operating profits and also the cash profit, which its ability to cover the interest has declined quite significantly from both cash and non-cash operating profit, which is a very worrying aspect, obviously. I mean, just highlighting these issues there. As the first slide on the financial position, we've shown that there are more assets came into to operations, which would have also meant depreciation would have increased, and certainly we've seen increasing depreciation by 20%. But also there's also accelerated depreciation in some of the areas which has led to increase in depreciation. But I think some of the discussion that we've picked up out there is that the depreciation might increase quite more rapidly going forward, which would obviously affect the margins, the profits, the profitability of the entity going forward. Now, in this slide, Chair and Honourable Members, what we're emphasising is the issue I just mentioned there, that the finance costs have increased. But I think what we're trying to show there is how much the cost of debt has increased over the years. I think over the past 9 years, 5 years or so, we've seen a threefold increase in the cost of debt, which signifies that there's been a lot of debt, either having to get more debt or having to extend debt, and you know there's been a lot of increase in the cost of debt over the years. And as you see, also the ratio interest cover ratio, which indicates how much is the ability of the entity to cover the interest, has also declined quite significantly thereof. I mean, you know, lastly, I think this slide also tries to emphasize the issue of decrease in profitability from operation particularly, because, you know, if I mean, I said earlier on the main issue here, which, you know, we look at when we analyze the financials and particular performance, it's around the production, around the cost of sales, which we normally call cost of sales. But certainly, the earnings before depreciation, tax, and others, which are not directly related to operations, have been declining quite a lot, which shows that certainly the costs have been going high, and the ability for the entity to cut the production costs has actually been deteriorated further in a negative way. I think that's what the first two bullets are trying to emphasize there. But also, what also becomes a bit of an issue, it's an inability for the entity to raise money from the market to deal with some of the concerns or to address some of its capital and current expenditure challenges. Hence, we have this bailout or request for additional money and so on. And we've seen also deterioration of the plants, which led to use of diesel and some compared to the previous year. The other point, Chair and Honourable Members, it's the issue around uncertainty, going concern. You know, it's a big issue. It's been in place for quite a number of years. And I think we had colleagues from the National Treasury yesterday indicating that one of the reasons why they had to appropriate 2021 additional debt was try to deal with this concern from the auditors. But I think there's a lot of issues that are still outstanding there, which really needs being addressed. I mean, the fact that the current assets and the difference between the current assets and current liabilities is very high, you know, and is in this state how, you know, when you sit as a committee try to derive a strategy going forward, how do you set up mechanisms that, the entity, government, are in a way to set a plan to say how do we reduce this place over a long time? Because clearly, when you look at the last bullet, the ESCOM sees the government support as part of its income stream or whatever, I don't know what you're going to call it, but as part of its, main source of finance, you know, and I don't think it's probably, well, it's a discussion we can, that should be had later, but I think you want to have a point whereby entity is able to say at least we can break even or at least we can have, meet our commitments over a long time. And you know, and I think, you know, we would think that that's what the committee also want to suggest as a part of the recommendations. Last slide. I think what we're showing in this slide, Chair and Honourable Members, is that the ability for the entity to repay its debt, but looking at the earnings over the debts over earnings, it from 2015, which you know, you 2015, okay, the lower the ratio, the better the entity is to meet, to repay its debt. That's basically in a, if you go down to zero, it means you're getting stronger and stronger and stronger to meet your, repay your debt, you know, look at the earnings and the extent of debt. But now you see from 2015, it was declining. You know, the bridge was getting, the entity was getting more stronger to be able to meet its, or repay its debt. That's not referring to the cost of debt, but be able to pay its debt. And 2018, from 2018, it went back up, which means clearly there were some more debts, either debt or the both debt was, there was more debt required, or the profitability of the entity deteriorated further. This is just to illustrate some of the challenges and what comes in there. Yes, they borrowed more debt to get the 2019 function going, ratio going quite higher, going, take us backwards. But I think also, that also talked to the earnings, obviously, there isn't, the profitability has also deteriorated over time there. So that's, in a sense, what we wanted to share with the committee, to say there are different stakeholders that have a role to play within the whole scenario, and it should be clarified how each role player will play his role going forward and take into account some of the challenges of the entities. But I think what we were also saying when we had discussions earlier and sometimes also having, you know, a long-term strategy in this thing. You know, we can have, you know, a piecemeal looking at bailout, looking at ESCOM, but there's certainly a broader issue, you know, within all or most of the state-owned companies to say what is going to be the strategy in oversight of the entities and you know, if in the short time, long term, and so on. You know, that's what we emphasize in there as a point. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Tanji. And Nelia. Okay. Thank you, Nelia and Dr. Tanji, for the presentation. I'm going to allow members to ask questions for clarity. Comment on the presentation or actually probe, if for lack of a better word, I'll use the word probe because we want to get deeper into the presentation to make us understand the situation that we are in and this elephant that we are dealing with. How deep is it, the injured? How deep is the injury? Can the members indicate by raising their hands? Honorable Ryder? Honorable Kiva? For now? Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. A number of questions. I note not all the slides are numbered, but I'm going to refer to slide numbers in the order. Slide 5 is my first question, just relating to the capitalized loan before 2010, that $60 billion, it was highlighted yesterday as well. If you can just indicate to me, was the loan raised before 2010 and then actually capitalized in 2010, or was it a loan that was then immediately capitalized? How did that work? You know, was it a... You understand what I'm saying. Thank you. Okay, the next one. Slide 7. You mentioned that the draft conditions had been provided at a meeting. Those were provided at a meeting, I believe, of the standing committee, not of the select committee. So we're a little bit in the dark. Obviously, we've had our discussions with our caucus colleagues. But just to try and, you know, indicate that both committees need to be treated a little bit similarly, so if we can get an indication of what those draft conditions are, I'm not sure, I presume it came from Treasury, not from yourself. So if you can maybe help us to be informed, that would be nice. Obviously, I'm sure though you don't have those on hand now, but if you can provide them in due course. Slide 8 is quite interesting for me, and I'm going to make a point which I'm going to highlight or ask a question on a little bit later. That indicates who can kind of put conditions where. And it's quite important to note that the Minister of Finance has limited and indirect powers to put conditions on Eskom. So the Minister of Finance puts conditions on the DPE, and then DPE are the guys that put on the conditions to Eskom. If you can just confirm that, and as I say, I'm going to ask a question about that later. Good, and then, yeah, so slide 9 then, and it relates a little bit further to a comment the doctor made on one of the last slides. The comment was made yesterday, the $59 billion that is being appropriated that we're actually investigating now relates to the fact that the AG is wanting to ensure that the going concern label can be placed on the financial statements. Can you just indicate the $59 billion, is it all going to go into current or to help the current ratio, or is some of it going to be apportioned to longer term or longer term liabilities, etc., the reduction of longer term liabilities, just to give me an idea of where that money is going to be spent, that will, I think, help us with monitoring the conditions. Slide 10, just on a lighter note, it actually looks fantastic until one looks at the x-axis labels, because normally we start from current and it's a straight line, but I mean this looks fantastic until you look at the x-axis labels. Yeah, just a lighter comment. I think it would have been useful, I think, to kind of get an impression of this all the way from, or to in this case, but from 2009, when the debt started to escalate. I think that would have helped tremendously for us, so that we could kind of compare it to the table on slide 5, which gives us that from 2009 picture. Again, just to build a trend over time and see what the impact is. Slide 11, and I want to make a comment about the third bullet point. And again, I made the point yesterday, but I'm going to keep on banging on us, okay? You say there that NERSA revenue tariffs, and I think it's tariff increases perhaps that you're talking about there, are unreflected of cost of sales and other expenditure. And I want to make the point that NERSA has a mandate, and I want to make the point here quite strongly that because of the developmental mandate of Eskom has been abused for self-enrichment, okay, so that's state capture, okay. So therefore I want to say that the cost of sales that you're referring to in this point is unreflective of market-related cost of inputs. Okay, so passing that on to the consumers is not fair. If you look at the next slide, you speak about a lack of effective management steps to deal with irregular and fruitless expenditure. You're talking about procurement and contract management not in line with regulations, etc. So I think that we need to, before we start castigating NERSA, we need to just remember that. You know, they're also there to act as a control mechanism, and they have a mandate. Slide 12. I want to question this issue of employee benefits increased by 13%, and I want to make it quite clear I don't understand employee benefits in the slightest, and certainly not even my own. Okay. So if you can just give me a little bit of a better idea, because, you know, we all read in the press that, 7% is the increase. How can that go up to 13%? That's quite scary to me, and I don't understand the explanation that comes on the next slide. So if you can just put some more info on that for me. Good. And then slide 17. Third bullet point. I don't understand I obviously understand this has been written in shorthand for brevity, but responsibilities of public enterprises is to make the transfer, and I'm not sure what you mean by not clear of its mandated responsibilities. If you can just explain that to me, please. And then your second last one, Eskom's financial position makes it difficult to raise funds from the market. I'm wondering if you can just give me an indication. I think it should be one of our conditions that Eskom doesn't raise further funds from the market, because it's kind of got to a situation where we're using the credit card to pay off the bond. If you can just give me your inputs on that. Thank you, Chair. I'm done.
Thank you, Aaron Pila.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank the tremendous for this presentation. My first question, Chair, would be to check if this presentation is information drawn from ESCOM itself, or it is your own research. And the second question is that if you got it from ESCOM, have you really conducted an analysis which dig deep in terms of the context and what is actually obtained within ESCOM? The third question is that we are told that there are long-term contracts, coal contracts, which actually predates the new dispensation. Some of them are 40 years, some of them are 50 years, and these contracts seem to be of business oligarchs, which actually is a permanent feature of service providers. We would like to ask a question in that context. As you make this presentation to us, I don't hear you favoring us with suggestions, for instance, that says that if we're to review some of these contracts, we may get to the bottom of the problem, because there are suggestions out there that it is these contracts that are actually bleeding ESCOM into the state of affairs that it finds itself. Because unless we make the right diagnosis, we're not going to come up with the right medicine. I think the purpose of this function is not to address the ESCOM problem in a piecemeal fashion. We want a permanent solution to this predicament that faces the nation. So it needs to be exposed. If this is intentional, if this crisis actually benefits other people and they want this crisis to be maintained and sustained so that they can continue to milk the state resources. The colleague has just spoken about the state capture. I am of the view that ESCOM was captured before our liberation. And if 25 years down the line we are unable to liberate ESCOM itself, then we have a fundamental problem. Because as a key asset to the nation, we cannot allow an organization like that to go down and dwindle year by year, wherein we take resources that are required by the poor and we keep on pumping them only to enrich a particular mafia that has not been exposed. So I'm trying to say that what you are presenting to us here is not making a critical analysis of what is actually happening on the ground. I think you need to go beyond what you are telling us and empower us that as we make decisions and as we come with some conditions that we must put to the executive, those are informed by your analysis, but also a recommendation that you may make to us. You must be a developmental civil servant and official who must work you know, in the best interest of the population of our country. And I want to move. I see you say, for instance, here, decline in electricity sales led to decrease in production in Eskom generation sources. I believe that the population of South Africa is growing. How dare do you have a scenario of sales declining? Because if you look at a supply and demand, I can tell you without any scientific research that there's a huge demand for electricity in this country. And there are actually projects that have stalled because in terms of power facilities, they are unable to get a guarantee that there will be electricity. So this is contradiction in terms as far as I'm concerned. So, Chair, it would be great to say that as part of the conditions that we may place on the executive is that we may ask for a review of those contracts, and if it needs be, maybe we, for this purpose, we ask the AG to sort of audit those contracts and look at them quite incisively so that we can have an informed picture of what is happening there. And I would have thought that, colleagues, you would have also spoken to the issue of the process which has been started by the President to look at separating Eskom into three entities, generation, transmission, and distribution, so that as we talk about this, this is also also taken into account as a solution to some of these problems. I will leave it at that, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Any other members who want to come in? Okay. What is this? Thank you, honorable members. Thank you for the presentation, PBO. And with the understanding that your mandate is to give us an answer of the situation, I'll start on the slide number 5. Where we speak about, it shows about the guarantee which was given to Eskom in 2009, the 60 million, billion, sorry, the 60 billion, and in 2015-16 financial year is the 23 billion. What I would like to know is, As analysts, especially the PBO, what impact has this intervention had in Eskom? I would also want to know your observation, PBO, and your view with regard to the Department of Public Enterprise. The capacity to oversee the expenditure and performance of its entities. Remember yesterday we were spoken about this, that we'll appreciate to have an overall long-term or permanent intervention where we can have peaceful sleep to know that we will not wake up in the morning and be told that there's a problem. And whether is there capacity in the entity itself to manage? We understand that the restructuring officer has been appointed. There will be an office and all those things, and there has been a commitment from the Department of Public Enterprise that there will be upskilling and reskilling of the employees. But I would like to get your view in terms of these issues that I'm raising. On the issue of the cost, what is your view, the cost of personnel at ESCOM? Is the entity able to pay, like, are they able to manage its personnel at this stage? I'm asking this question because we want to understand the value for money that we're injecting into the entity. Where is it going to help? Who is going to benefit from the intervention? The other concern, okay, I'll come to that one. On slide 7, you are speaking about the conditions for the transfer. And one of the members has raised an issue about the conditions being made available to the standing committee. Yesterday, we have asked Treasury. I wanted to know to which extent will our input, because even when we engage, we're trying to say to you, these are the things that you should look into in terms of the condition and those issues that have been raised by the public during the public hearing. And I want to emphasize that the conditions should be given to this committee before the finalization of the approval of the bill, so that we understand what we are doing, and if we are asked questions, we are able to answer, and we are able to hold whoever is responsible. On this slide, there's a choice of ways. The Minister of Finance in writing. Roman figure 1, you said may impose conditions. That is before, prior. And then Roman figure 2, you say must impose conditions after. Why the choice of words? The legal gurus will help us, but also as the authors of this presentation, you can assist us to understand, because the little knowledge that I have, there's a difference between that. I also like the Roman figure 4. Under Roman figure 2 of 3. The minister in writing must stop the use of any part of the amount in respect of which conditions have been imposed in terms of subparagraph 2 until such conditions are met. Hence, I'm saying it will be appreciated if we have those conditions as a committee and we know what is the minister expecting from the entity and the department. I also like the bullet, the second from bottom, that says National Treasury must disclose the stoppage of an allocation in its next quarterly report to the Committee on Finance of the Committee on Finance of the National Assembly of the National Council of Progress. That recommendation, I know we are not making decisions today as a committee. We are still looking into your analysis, but as we discuss, we will indicate where we feel uncomfortable and where we feel comfortable, and that also will inform our decisions. The most important one, I think, as part of the condition, the last bullet, any part of the amount not transferred to ESCOM by the end of the relevant financial year reverts to the National Revenue Fund. I think there should be a must, capital letter and bold. Must be reverted to the National Revenue Fund. I think for me that's very important. If you have not utilized it for that particular financial year, like any other conditional grants that have been given to departments, it must not be diverted or redirected to be utilized for something else. So the conditions continue also on slide 8. And this analysis from PBO speaks to what we've been raising. And I want to thank PBO for that, for your analysis. The approval of the, that's slide number 8, the approval of this bill is subject to the condition. By the Minister of Finance, the Minister of Public Enterprise and ESCOM. The roles, the conditions. The Minister of Finance has to have some kind of memorandum of understanding as a condition to Department of Public Enterprise as the mandated department responsible for the entity. That is a good thing. The reporting line should be clear. Who is supposed to report where? Who is supposed to do what with whom? Those lines must not be blurry, they must be very clear. And the Minister of Public Enterprise as the political head responsible for this entity. We also expect conditions that comes from him because he's responsible for this entity. He's overseeing the functioning of this entity. If anything goes wrong in ESCOM, the first to blame, the first the first name that will, or the first office that will come to the public and ask is the minister, because he has a political responsibility and the mandate to oversee the functioning of this entity. You know, this issue of the IPPs, I raised it yesterday, that the cost is 25% of overall production cost, and yet it contributes 5%. Maybe we can be assisted in terms of this misalignment. Why is it so? As especially speaking at this time. Yesterday we have also raised the issue of the lack of consequence management. Hence there will be findings by the auditor on fruitless expenditure, irregular expenditure, and all these things. But there are no steps or corrective measures that have been taken. Hence, we'll always have this and no improvement. what is your view as Parliamentary Budget Office? Because also you are a resource to us. We rely on you. I'm a bit concerned on slide 14. That graph, it doesn't give me hope. That increment, it goes up to 2020 or 2021, until 2020. So the projection, it tells us, even if we intervene, there will still be this increment of that. What is concerned about is sustainability. Because everything that we are doing, we are expecting Eskom to be independent, to be sustainable, to be able to raise its own revenue, to can run its own business and mandate. There is something that you have raised on slide 15 about Eskom seeing government support as part of turnaround strategy and income for the entity. It's like it's given. Eskom knows that we can't do without. We take it very serious. And when they have problems, there will be a bailout from government. And when we talk about Eskom as Eskom, there are people, there are human beings, own bodies, that are doing wrong things in the name of Eskom and are crippling this elephant that we're trying to rescue. Yesterday, we spoke about the state capture, the corruption that is happening. The open secret is there, and we say, as the committee, we can't promote, we can't be seen approving funds, public funds, to go and fund corrupt activities. That is a no-no. And this is why we want to see the conditions. The approval, I always say there's no black check. The approval is on conditions, and the condition is the condition. What are the conditions? Based on the condition, we will be able to approve. We want to be convinced. And until such time, I think that the actions are taken, people are made to account and pay when necessary for what they have done, this will be an ongoing thing, just like it's happening in SAA. And it can't be. I have raised yesterday the issue of the public trust. We have lost it. Eskom have lost it. You know, over the weekend, I happened to watch with my son a comedy Don Schuster talking about making a joke about Eskom thing, and people were unaware that it was Don Schuster. They were freely expressing their frustration and their anger about Eskom. So it just shows that we have come to a stage where we have now become a joke, but a joke that we cannot laugh about, a joke that leaves us to cry. It's not a good thing. The reflection is not good. So we have to make sure that we gain trust, we earn trust, because trust just can't just come from the ground. We have to work. We have to do things, and the public must see that things have been done.
I think, honorable member, this presentation just came at the right time, whereby independently as a select committee, we are going to look into this, we input on this, and we think Treasury, by being here, together with the Department of Public Enterprise and ESCOM, understand the concerns and the addition to the condition as we go on. And I think we all know that we don't have the luxury of time. We are guided by the Money Bill Act in terms of processing this bill. So after it has been passed it has been passed in the NA, we'll be having 2 days. We'll be having 2 days in between to deal with it. So the sooner we get the conditions so that we can act and edit, the better. Maybe it might even help that we have a joint committee together with the NA, not as a stepchild, but as an independent house ourselves, sell our thinking to them so that the conditions are stringent. They don't come in peace now. Thank you very much. I'm going to hand over now to PBO. Members, you'll indicate if you want to come in. You're allowed to come in.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll mainly respond to some of the first questions. So, Honourable Member, that 59, it's in the bill. The bill is saying that it's to honour its obligation, so it's its debt obligation, the 59. But it's not just the 59. Next year they will possibly also appropriate that additional 23 that has been provided for. So there will be an appropriation, the new appropriation for 2020 will obviously have that additional 23 as well. And then in terms of the conditions, these conditions is also just taken from the amendments bill. So the Minister of Finance in terms of this bill will determine conditions to ESCOM. And the next slide is basically also to show just the reporting lines, because the Minister of Finance will transfer these amounts to DPE, and DPE will transfer these amounts to ESCOM. So all of them do have a role to play in terms of the reporting lines. And then the other one was in terms of slide, whether DPE has got the capacity. We looked at DPE's structure, They've got three programs in DPE. The biggest proportion of the funds are allocated to administration, unfortunately, and these amounts will be transferred from either Program 2 or Program 3 that has got different purposes. And in terms of the organizational structure, the DPE is showing that by the end of this financial year, they will have a full complement of staff in DPE. So we don't know whether that will be enough to do the monitoring of these amounts, but the positions in programs 2 and 3 are quite high level positions. They're mainly between levels on a management level. So we did look at the structure of DPE, the purpose of the programs, but what we also found that some of the transfers to ESCOM, the special appropriations bill, mainly they transfer from Program 3, but the amended appropriations bill earlier this year, that transfer they indicated in the appropriations bill that transfer will be transferred from Program 2. So there is a bit of confusion in terms of where they place the money and where they transfer it from in terms of the program structure. I'll come in later if I need to.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members, for the questions. I want to start the question, to answer some of the questions in saying, in 2015, we've done some work where we looked at the state-owned entities and some of the issues. The work was commissioned by the Standing Committee on Appropriations. And I think we can make the work available to the committee as well, as part of the support information. But I think one of the things that came up from that work, Chairman, was that, look, the bigger issue is the some of the key issues that many of state-owned companies are faced with is the issue of the duplicate mandate, having your commercial mandate and developmental mandate, and that in a way as part of the challenges within the market failures in addressing some of the socio-economic challenges or issues that are faced by society, by economy, where government, say, let's have entities that address these challenges that private entities will not necessarily be addressing those issues. And obviously that creates an expectation that government, says these are our responsibilities and we're taken over by the entities. And I think in the paper that we did in 2015, I have a presentation with me here, we also said one of the issues that was recommended also by the Presidential Commission of Presidential Review Commission on State Entities was that government needs to get to a point whereby it, deliberately look at the non-commercial mandate of some of the entities, to say these are non-commercial mandate of the entities. Look at ESCOM, how it supports small business, how it does electricity, cannot increase electricity at a certain level, as Honourable Wright was saying alone, and say these are the non-commercial objectives or mandate that will be taken up by different state-owned companies, and how much that is, how much will that be? I had a colleague from National Treasury touching on this yesterday. How much will that be, non-commercial mandate? And the assumption there will then be that will be the responsibility of government, not of the side of of an entity as a commercial entity. Now, any support will probably be aligned to that cost of it. So this is how much we see state-owned companies, non-commercial mandate be. So how much it costs, capital costs, and current costs over a certain time, and support of government will be aligned to that aspect. And I think, I still think that is a very important aspect to take into account in any long-term strategy in discussing, as I was saying, we look at the SOE as a whole, not necessarily as Eskom, because especially when you're trying to look at long-term strategies and dealing with some of the challenges that they have to say, because you find that in some entities or companies, you know, it's easy for them to claim, non-commercial mandate when they're doing poorly, or claim commercial mandate when they're doing well. So it's always conflicted inside, and hence, you know, the support is quite difficult. So I think the point I'm trying to emphasize here is that would probably help as a part of oversight to get, say, what is non-commercial mandate and how would government take that, cause that, and say how to, as parliament, oversight over that. You know, and you say, look, this is 600 billion, it's commission, non-commissional mandate. Any support will be aligned to it. Beyond that, it will not necessarily be a part of it. So hence, you see Eskom having these challenges. To some extent, it's beyond Eskom's frustration. Of course, there are issues, governance issues and so on, but there is that having built up expectations of non-commissional mandate that the end companies, Eskom and others, had to take into account. And you know, we've not had that discussion, how much is it, you know, and how much it cost, and what will be the support in that. Hence, you know, the question has always been that you can't let the entity fail because the poor will suffer, and which is true, and the economy will suffer. You know, it's both being lumped together. So I think that's one of the points I wanted to start my discussion in response to the question, say, you know, we see putting it around that as a strategy, oversight strategy going forward over the short, medium, and the long term in this regard. And I think that also talks to the issue from argument around NERSA, as Alberto was saying there, you know, and trying to deal with some of the issues. I think coming back to the employee benefits, I tried saying that we're not saying 13% is how much the employee benefits is increased by, but just saying the figure between 2018 and 2019 has increased by, Nadia, you just go through a slide. The figure between 2018 and 2019 has increased by 20%, just a comparative analysis there. And what we even say in the sub-bullet after that is to show that bulk of that is 1.8 billion, which is really, this is, of course, from the financial reports. You know, it's really within the pension benefits, and 27% is from the salaries increase. Salaries were increased by 7%, not necessarily by 13% there. So I think that clarifies the point. And I think the point of whether the cost, you know, that the employee costs are sufficient and insufficient, I looked at the Department of Enterprise, they had a presentation last week with the standing committee there, you know, pull out that presentation. They're showing a comparative of the 10-year trend of the, you know, expenditure, say how much were the what was the entity's performance in 2007 and what was entity's performance in 2019, and you realize that bulk of the changes were in production, primary expenditure, revenue, in terms of the value, the revenue, and other aspects, and you realize that employee cost hasn't increased as much as those other components have increased in a way as cost to the entity. But of course, the numbers have increased by more than 10,000 for over 10 years' time. You see numbers increasing by 10,000 times. So I think that's useful information to have. But I think in terms of capacity, the report also does indicate that the capacity is increased and the employee capacity, you know, in dealing with some of the issues. It does quite provide some substantive details. So, of course, for us to come to answer the question, we probably need to go and have more substantive analysis. But I thought that slide was quite useful to show the indication that ESCOM, Department of Enterprise, have done some analysis in that regard there. We have done some work before on ESCOM, because also what we did say, we done some work in 2017 where we looked at some of the issues around ESCOM. We can also follow up on that, because I think this presentation was really a build up from that work, then, you know, And I think Siraj will comment on that a bit later as well. You know, when Dr. Mohammed will comment on that later when he comes in. But I think, we do emphasize the issue of governance issues there, which the entity put out in place, you know, in to say these are the challenges that we have as Eskom, at least picked up by the auditors as well, which says these are the challenges that we have, and this mechanism that we put in place to try to deal with those challenges. I suppose then, from oversight point of view, is to take those who say, this is what you said you're going to do, to address some of the challenges that you're seeing, or that's been noted by the auditors or by other stakeholders, and what's the plan to deal with those. And I think when you do your oversight, you also always the conditions, you also try to attach those as a mechanism of you know, ensuring the entity comes back to be compliant and to at least they have a break even in a way, you know, of course take into account some other factors there. So we can also share that as well as the work that we've done before. But I think, like I say, there are specific issues that were raised or concerns, governance issues raised in the financial reports, in the auditor's reports, and the entity has said, no, we'll put this in place, we'll deal with this in place over some time, and departments as well as we'll do this as part of our role, as I said. But I think that could come as part of the committee's conditions or long-term strategy to hold government and the company to account, ensuring that some of the issues don't recur and so on. And of course, the issue of production costs, as I emphasized the chair and honourable members, that certainly, I see it as a more bigger issue, that the costs certainly are quite higher. And you know, and then you see the report as well, and some of the commentators also does talk to that the costs, production costs particularly, the core costs are quite high, have increased quite rapidly. Of course, there's been a lot of argument, discussion around the coal price being beyond that. You know, the fact remains the costs are quite higher than what the entity is able to generate as revenue. We can argue about other aspects, but the way when you look at the costs, how they've increased, the primary costs, how they've increased in that table as well, the revenue has increased by 300% over 10 years. The costs have increased by 600%. That tells you that the costs have actually escalated quite rapidly compared to that. But of course, there could be other issues of the plant's lifespan coming to close, which also could increase the cost of production. Of course, I'm not an electricity expert there, but I mean, the fact that I'm trying to emphasize is the costs are way higher and have increased quite rapidly and so on. So I think when to put that as well, 60 billion and so on, I think maybe we'll want to go and look into that, where is the money, you know, what was the loan, when does the loan came into place, we'll look at that and maybe send that to the chair, to the committee. I think I've addressed quite a lot of the MDPME capacity management. Yeah, I think there are some medications that, I'm trying to check whether I've covered everything before I bring in Dr. Mohammed, Siraj Mohammed to come in. I mean, the issue of IPPs, I mean, Siraj will talk to that, but of course there was contracts that were signed in at a particular rate, which has come in, and I mean, the way it works internationally, it's the you realize the benefits over time, as I understand. You know, you fix the rate at a particular, you know, the cost at a particular rate for a certain time, and the next round you'll get a lower rate because of the initial investments quite higher. And I think that's the reality, and maybe, meaning that's where the costs are, and you know, there's probably limited room for the company to move. But you know it's the fact that it's the issue that is sitting at in this regard. I've covered quite the ground that I wanted to cover. Thank you, Siraj. You want to come in?
Thank you, Chair, honourable members. I'm going to keep my comments short. I think the one thing I want to raise was that, I mean, the current hearings and the special appropriation bill has been very much focused on the financing side and making sure that Eskom is able to meet their obligations over the next 2 or 3 years. And so, I mean, I think the work that we've done and sort of building on what, as Dr. Jansen said, building on what we've done before and what we presented has been very much focused on that, but then also bringing in, thinking through the state of Eskom in terms of its operating costs, but also its growing debt costs and interest savings, and then thinking through the conditions linked to that. Now, I heard what the honourable member said about us giving you deep analysis and understanding things more deeply, and I just want to say that I agree with that, and we do try to do that. But given the time, and also given the other things we work on as a relatively small office in terms of technical staff, we are unable to actually know everything about Eskom. And also, there's a huge amount that's still in the dark. I mean, if you think about Medupi and Kusile, each of those operations had more than 40 different construction contracts with Eskom. And a lot of that still hasn't come out as Zondo. It's still not transparent, you know, what has happened. If you look at the honorable member spoke about coal contracts, I mean, we need to differentiate between long-term cost-plus contracts where you build a coal-fired power station on the mine, and then, you know, the land will belong to Eskom, but you have an operator that works it. And those mines are 30, 40 years old now, and Eskom has long-term contracts basically to draw coal out of that. And as those mines lie, the amount of coal is depleted, the costs increase from those. And to some extent, Eskom, there have been some contracts where Eskom has been involved in recapitalizing those mines. There's been situations where families like the Guptas have tried to get involved and to push out the old players and take over and re-sign contracts, get prepaid contracts for coal, Eskom paying more for coal, and a lot of that hopefully it's going to be clarified by the Zondo Commission and other areas. And so we see that the situation in coal and the sort of the old operators and then the trying to bring in new operators, some of them not corrupt, I must say. I mean, a lot of them not corrupt. But in that process, a lot of people within Eskom, including people who've now been pushed out from the board and the executive management of Eskom still have a lot of questions to answer. And I don't want to mention names within the committee meeting, but also then it also extends into government departments and even ministers that still have questions to answer about how certain contracts are answered. And so that's something that, you know, we can't really go into the depth of that, and also a lot of that is unclear and not transparent. So some of the other thing about the coal contract is that there was a process, I think, and this is the difficulty, because some of these things become blurred as people see the opportunity to skim money off the top, especially what happened in how Eskom managed the selling. There was at one point they decided they were moving away from longer term contracts. So I'm talking about outside of the cost plus mine. And what happened there was then to set up new contracts and new suppliers, but also their new transport contracts as well. And there we saw that in a matter of, so I'm trying to get the number, the year, it's such a long period, and these things happen. You need to know specific things there. But it seemed like over a 4 or 5 year period, the coal price went up three times a ton as those contracts changed. Then what's happened now is as Eskom is trying to fix things up, they're going back into the market and saying we actually now want to make sure that we can provide ourselves with the security of longer term contracts. But a lot of the mining companies, especially the ones within easy reach of where they need the coal, are now basically, some of them are exporting to India and China, who have built a huge number of coal-fired stations and use low-grade coal like ours. But also, the minute you, somebody of the size of Eskom comes into the market, it actually changes the supply-demand dynamics and pushes up the price. And so last year, when Eskom came in and said, we need to secure our supply, the price went up 17%, right? At the time when inflation was 4.5%. So we're seeing the kind of mixed effects of poor management, and not understanding if the poor management was linked to Eskom and advice they were getting from their people or consultants, but also for the ability of people to skim money from the top, to steal money in that process. And so it's very hard for us at this point to actually, until we understand what's happened and the forensic audits have happened and people have been charged and those things, to come and say, you know, these people are responsible and these not, and to provide that deep analysis, which I think the member was asking for. So we do have, I think, a general sense. We do have a general timeline. There was stuff that was done within government. There's stuff that's coming out of Zondo. And so maybe at some point, if we do want to look at that in more depth in the future, when things are more transparent, we could maybe bring a presentation to members. And also look at the role of sort of the majors and others in that process. Because I think that is important. And the reason why I'm going into this into that much detail is that the process of financing Medupi and Kusile wasn't upfront financing. They have to keep raising money in different tranches. And so it comes in the process of keeping money coming in. And the covenants on the existing debts, the conditions that they actually put out for people that they're selling their bonds to and getting loans from, one of the covenants clearly state that in cases of where there's corruption and poor management, that they can actually call in the debt, right? Which means that they will then have to, they can call in on government guarantees of that debt. And so the process of governance and fixing up governance is really important. So we're trying to do two things in parallel. One is we're trying to understand where the corruption is, who's involved, whether people are still in Eskom and whether they're still feeling. On the other side, we're trying to say we've got conditions and we need to clear up the governance processes. And the new board and the new management of Eskom has set in place a 5-point plan for that. So I won't go into more detail of that. I can send members some more information on that, but I think as part of my colleagues Nelia and Masali spoke about, as part of that process of oversight and looking at the different roles of DPE, Minerals and Energy, and Treasury, clarifying how Parliament relates to those in their oversight, and especially in terms of cleaning up the governance. In terms of the IPPs, I think I'm just going to stop with the IPPs. There've been four windows for auctions. The first one was the biggest, and the first one was the most expensive. And then we've had a second one, which was smaller, and then a third and a fourth one. Between the first and the third one, we saw like the prices for solar photovoltaic average prices dropping by about 70%, and then from window 3 to 4, a further 30%. The people that I'm speaking to understand much more about this than I do at the universities and in CSIR are telling me that the prices that we were getting in the later parts of window 3 are lower than new coal and if we were to build another nuclear power station. And so As the Masani was saying, currently Eskom is paying a large share linked to the cost incurred in Windows 1, 2, but over time we begin to see more of those average costs come in. One of the problems is that one of the honourable members spoke about that is the supply and demand. Currently, because of the state of the economy, we've seen declining demand for electricity. At the same time, because of Eskom's problems, there's still limitations on certain large users. And Eskom is part of the turnaround strategy, and this is a question for, I think about our environmental and other sustainability plans going forward. Part of the plan is looking at how they can actually sell more electricity to large-scale electricity-intensive users in the future in order to increase demand. And having said that, I think one of the very big challenges for Eskom going forward is, you know, once government steps in and helps them with the financing side, is how to manage the cost. I think because there's so much unclarity about what's happening with coal, and coal is one of the major costs, that's going to be very hard for them to manage and keep down coal costs. Two is because of the age of the plant, they're going to struggle. They say they want to manage that better, but they're not always going to know when maintenance will happen and need to happen. And so we still may need to use more diesel, and diesel is a big part of the cost. Big share of the cost, and we're hoping that over time we're going to see the cost of the IP reducing. But if demand moves back to where it was before, we're going to see Eskom basically sitting with an oversupply. So they're also talking about trying to sell not more only to electricity intensive users, but also to neighboring countries. To manage that. So I think in the conditions, someone in government, whether it's DPE or Treasury, is going to have to be able to sit on Eskom and monitor those operating costs as well. I'm going to end there and just say any other questions. Thank you.
What an intense, informative presentation over another presentation. Much appreciated. Very interesting subject. I'm going to allow members to have a second bite. Honorable Jandu.
Jandu.
And Honorable Ryder.
Chair, thank you very much. Good morning. Chair, I think I would want to make an emphasis on the analysis. I think the committee would really need that in-depth analysis because how are we going to ensure that you root out the roots so that we don't have a situation of a turnaround strategy to be a turnaround circle. Now, when you are in a turnaround circle, you don't know where is the end point, the starting point and the end point. So I think that in-depth analysis will really assist the committee because while we are busy now with the process of the special appropriation and money that's going to be given to Eskom for a turnaround, but how do we ensure that there's no continuity of while the Zondo Commission is busy, the Operation Committee is going to give money, but how do we ensure that those things which happened are no more continuing, happening underneath, which we don't know where the things are happening? How do we root out those things to say that, how do we get to an end or stop? Because if we don't know the state of the projects which are currently there undergoing, which we don't have that state as to the terms of how long those projects still is going to be, and also the contract of the coal that came out very clear in terms of, if we don't have that, it will also not giving the committee so clear in terms of when we make a decision. We make a decision on something that we are very clear of as to where do we put this money, not in a hole that this money is going to disappear somewhere. So I think, Chair, for me, just to emphasize on the issue of the analysis.
Honourable Ryder.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate your indulgence with the second round. It's a brand new question, and it relates more to yesterday's presentation than to what was presented today, and it may not have an answer for from today. The issue came about yesterday of discussing the contingency reserve and the fact that that contingency reserve needs to or might be the source of some of the disbursement of the remaining $4.1 billion, and then also because there was a potential red flag raised in case there's a failure by Eskom to execute their funding plan, which may result in a liquidity shortfall as of the 31st of March, which is in the current financial year. And considering the additional appropriation and the special appropriation and all of the extra little bits and pieces, other funding sources are running out. So just, yeah, to get back to the issue, the big question, that contingency reserve, what are the restrictions, limitations, conditions? Is there any kind of a limitation on what can be paid from that contingency reserve? How much gets apportioned to the contingency reserve, etc., etc.? I tried to research yesterday and I couldn't find too much other than what had been said in the budget speech at the beginning of the year. So what are the rules governing the contingency reserve, please?
I'll give you time to... Do you want to get a clarity from that question? Oh, okay. You all have an opportunity to respond. Doctor, when you were talking, you spoke on dual mandate of ESCO, the development mandate and the commercial mandate. The main issue here is the formula to fund the development mandate. And due to these challenges of the commercial mandate, of the funding model, the commercial mandate ends up subsidizing the development mandate. And according to my understanding, this will then cause the collapse of the entity if we are not clear on the other mandate. What I would like you to assist on, or my question is, how can this problem of the development, I mean the commercial mandate, the development mandate be resolved? I need an assistance from PBO as to whether the PBO can be able to assist or advise in terms of the 2015 cover that was spoken about earlier. So my question is about the two mandates, and I think the other one, which is the official, supersedes the development, and because of the unclear plan. So Can you assist in terms of that? Thank you.
I'll just attempt to give you just some of the answers to the contingent liabilities. I think contingent, not the liabilities, contingent reserve. The contingent reserve for this year is $13 billion. Normally that is used for unforeseen and unavoidable and will be allocated during the adjusted appropriations process. And in the past, the entire amount has been appropriated. So some of that can be used to allocate in the adjustments budget to some of these special needs from our entities.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. The question on the substantive, you know, analysis to determine the extent of the challenges, I think it's a valid question. And you know, clearly, when you read the financial records, and what has been said as well today, and also the presentation, there are indications that, you know, the potentially bailouts in the near future, whatever. But I think the way probably for committee would be to strengthen the conditions around the approving the special appropriations. But the indication from discussion yesterday and from the financial records, that, you know, like some of the money pays, it comes in to pay the debt as opposed to the use of production. You know, it has to pay the debt. And you know, that when you look at the interest coverage ratios as well, that tells you that largely the bailout it's also to pay for debt as opposed to be useful production. So, I mean, the point I'm trying to say is the conditions will be the ones that try to strengthen the oversight role. So, you know, we want to see certain things over time and also follow through, Chair, because, I mean, the key issues also follow through on some of the conditions in the near future and also, you know, be more precise in the follow-through process as well. And then the issue of the, you know, commercial mandate and non-commercial mandate, it is a, I think the issue has been discussed quite a lot in terms of, I mean, the issues to separate it too, because it does conflict in terms of funding, because it's easier for, particularly for those companies that have a clear market-driven strategy within the offering of the company. But I mean, in this case, I mean, in the work that we were doing, you know, some of the issues that maybe need to be explicitly separate them, you know, or say what will be the non-commercial mandate. Again, when you look at the Presidential Review Commission in 2011, it was linking that largely to South Africa being a trying to get South Africa to become a developmental state, which it is not, you know, so seeing the role, because it was also talking to restructuring some of the entities to see which entities in that, you know, arena are relevant to get the country to become a developing state and what would be those companies do in that regard. And I think I use the word non-commercial because it's lumped up together as a whole. But of course, it's also issue of dealing with dealing with socio-economic issues around the society and just being lumped up together. But I think the main issue is for government to separate the two within the entities, or attempt to separate the two between the entities and cost that non-commercial mandate, which in a case it's probably easier to say it as I say it than do it. But I think that was the main issue. And I was a bit excited yesterday when I had the colleagues on National Treasury mentioning it. Hopefully they're doing something about it to where you can also ask them how far you've done something in separating the two mandates from both commercial and non-commercial mandate of the student company. It's not only Eskom, you know, Jay, like other things. It's other companies as well which are seen to address both commercial and also strategic assets and so on. I think that's, in a sense, the funding, the argument really around there, so the funding would largely be focused on non-commercial mandate. You know, support, of course, you know, it will come in both elements, you know, capital and, you know, operational expenditure, you know, but then you know that how much would be the strategy to deal with the non-commercial mandate over some time. So I think that's what the sense what we're trying to get at. Of course, it's a very lengthy exercise to get to grip with that. But I think why I raised it was just to suggest that also we could think about it as part of the condition, say, why are we with in terms of having a long-term strategy in dealing with some of the challenges that are faced by not only Eskom but other state-owned companies. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, you want to come in again?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you're welcome.
Just if I may quickly add to this issue of due mandate. I think if we want to understand ESCOM's problems leading up to the building of Madupi and Kusile, and maybe including part of that period, was that it wasn't only a developmental mandate in terms of electrification. I think government was sending confusing signals to ESCOM, or ESCOM, and maybe to some extent the people wanted to extract wealth from ESCOM, took advantage of the situation. So you had, following BBE requirements within ESCOM, but also in terms of your suppliers. And so, for instance, if you look at the Exxaro coal mine situation, when Coco was the CEO, he pushed for Exxaro to have much more a percentage of black ownership than the BE rules required. And I'm not accusing him of anything in that. Maybe that ESCOM as an organization could have that right. But it raises the question of, were they trying to actually push Exxaro to give certain people more ownership within the organization, or was there corruption involved in that? And so, so to some extent, employment equity BE rules, which I think is something that the country requires given our past, can be used by certain people in a way that's not fair. With the building of Madupi and Kusile, a competitive supply development program, which is developed by DPE and included inputs by other economics departments, and was to say, well, we're going to have this huge building of new power plants costing billions in South Africa. are we going to get smaller players, black-owned companies, and others benefiting from that, from all kinds of contacts linked to that? And that, I think, in itself was a good thing, and if it was well managed and transparently managed, I think we could have had outcomes, even if it cost us a few billion more. I mean, what we had was rampant corruption. We're not sure about those 40 contracts or more construction contracts for each of those plants. And as far as I know, we haven't actually, none of those have been made public so far. I'm not sure if it's going to come out in Zondo or not. And so I think there was we've seen those prices more than double in some cases for the construction of the Madupi and Kusile. So I think going forward, one thing is, I think we have to have clarity within government of what the goals are, what kind of pressures we're going to put on the organization, and also not to see just if we don't have social requirements. I think we have social requirements on all corporations, whether they're public or private, and to not see those as bad things, but to see those things that have to be well managed and to be clear, and also to not give people the opportunity to be corrupt in implementing those. Let me end there.
Thank you very much, members. No last bite, you're fine. Welcome, Honorable Karim, who have noted your apology that you joined us late. PBO, thank you very much. These questions that we have asked, we have had us asking them yesterday, and we're trying to clear the blurry line, and some of the questions might come to FSC again, as we are now stepping to FSC for their presentation. I want to also emphasize and be clear, the guy who was representing Treasury has just left, but he has apologized. I wanted him to hear this, that as a committee, I'm sending this idea to the committee, because it shouldn't be my issue, that as a committee, we must agree that we resolve that we are going to set aside a meeting for a joint standing committee and select committee on appropriation to deal specifically with the conditions to be presented to us. So I want us to take that resolution and give the administration an opportunity to facilitate that that meeting. Can I hear from the members, Honourable Ryder, Honourable Karen?
Chair, I don't think a joint meeting is appropriate. I think the separation of the two houses is important in this, and I think that the standing committee should have first bite, and we should have a second bite. I don't believe a joint committee is appropriate.
I think there's no problem in having a joint meeting, provided we obviously don't take any decisions on the basis of that. The advantage of a joint meeting is that you know, there are more members of parliament from all parties, including the DA, who are there, and we can hear them. The other absurdity might be, okay, let's not have the joint meeting, then what we can do is you can get a recording of it and give it to each of us and we can listen to it, right? It's the same thing. In any case, as I remember it, a certain very active person on the NCOP side used to watch us on Channel 408. He used to then ask the secretary, our secretary, Alan Wickham, for recordings. Because his idea was, and he was an excellent person, I don't want to mention his name, I don't have his permission, but just think, you know who I'm talking about, right? He often found it useful because, A, the members on the NEA side were focused on one committee, and they specialized in that committee. On the other side, I mean, take Mr. Ryder, Dennis himself is in thousands of committees, right? Myself, as a chair of one committee, I'm on 450,000 committees, which is why I'm not sure whether I can continue to serve on so many, but let's discuss that later. So I really think, you know, there are times when it's not appropriate for us to be there, but on conditions, actually. You know what? If you don't have a joint meeting, I'm going to go there and speak to Notolo and Joe and find out what they actually said. In any case, Dennis, you know it's one study group. Okay? That study group does not bind the NCOP comrades. It merely provides a framework. Many times we've gone to them and told them, no, we don't agree with you. As indeed the NCOP committee did to us twice last year, right? Alone. So then we have to give in on the NA side. So it's not like they decide for us. But Dennis, this thing is too complex, and we need to finish it reasonably quickly. I'm taken aback at how much of time, Chairperson, you are allocating. You have a patience I don't have. I'm very glad you are chairing, actually, because I would, as the officials here will know, have a different style, okay? So really, you're giving us a lot of time. A lot of time. And Dennis, I just plead on this one. They have more people there. They also have researchers there who have more, let's say, focused speciality. And if you put our researchers and theirs together, it's a pooling of minds. Now, I don't think there's any big disagreement across the parties, actually. If I knew what Dennis says, like yesterday he picked up three of my points, right, that I was going to raise anyway. So Dennis, with due respect, you are right. We should keep our independence, and the chair here and myself as the chair of Lerica are determined on that, and you must tackle us when we don't. But on this one, I would be very grateful, Dennis, if you're a bit more conciliatory on this one. We're not taking any decisions. We just want to hear what are their conditions. Even if we are part of that discussion, Dennis, it doesn't mean that we ourselves in the ANC, let alone you, will agree with your colleagues on that side. When we look at it, there may be angles we will see later down the road that they don't see. There are provincial dynamics here that we may see, that you know, from Mpumalanga and so on, you know, at least the chairperson, that they don't see because of a different perspective. I think I've gone on for too long and I've been roundabout here. If I were you, if you were me, you would have cut me short 5 minutes ago.
Fortunately, I'm not Zulu. Honourable Mkiva.
No, I want to support Comrade Karim, but already I could see Mr. Dennis nodding. So I wanted to say that the two houses are not necessarily competing, but they work to complement each other. If there's something that has been overlooked in the other house, we may pay more attention to the detail and pick up such issues. So I'm saying that we are one parliament, as it were. But in the interest of time, and given the fact that we are constrained since we started our work late as a result of the election, you know. So I think it is important that we may make a special dispensation and allow for the two committees to sit for that purpose in particular. So thank you very much.
To further persuade you, Honorable Ryder, I think I'm also looking at the cost effectiveness and time availability of the people, resource people whom we are going to expect to come and make that presentation. Honorable Karim is correctly putting it. I'm not saying we are going to take a decision. We are going to have our own session as an SOPing select committee to take decisions. But this is, we are still on the processing part. So I just want us to save ourselves time and save the departments and other stakeholders, those that are going to be part of the team that is going to present the conditions to us. I throw your hand up.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I note the submissions and comments from other members. I will obviously go with the majority, and I understand that that's how it works. I do think that there are benefits in us sitting in a joint meeting, but I certainly don't want us to be bound by that. And I also want to warn the members that we can also then be subsumed into the thinking of the majority in that environment, and that is what I was hoping to avoid, so that we can be given a thoroughly fresh second look at the issue, rather than to have one that has gone through the same process as the National Assembly has gone. But I understand that there are benefits, and as long as we are not, as I say, bound by any decisions and forced down any particular path.
No, I want to thank Dennis for being conciliatory. He doesn't have to be. And we don't want to vote on these things. Not literally vote. These are the astonishing thing, Dennis. I'm being very honest. I'm speaking from my heart. Well, I disagree with you, I do. Actually, there's very little difference between what your party is saying in the media. Frankly, and many of us, I can't speak to the ANC, but many of us, well, certainly me. Let's start with me. Let me speak for myself, because who do I represent here? So, myself and the DA. As much as I'm a Marxist and they are Thatcherite right-wingers, the truth of the matter is that we do agree. Right, firstly. Secondly, I'm teasing, obviously, for those of you who don't know me. Secondly, why am I? Am I teasing? Well, that's what I'm saying. But anyway, so secondly, what I want to say is, okay, let's, you know, the English have this saying, right? There is what? The proof of the pudding is in the eating, right? We can go there, let's put it to the test. And I want to suggest that with two strong chairpersons and an emerging team that's new, they're finding their feet, and they're doing very well for people who've come, if you like, from the wilderness. We came, you know, like this in 1994, and others came through the provincial legislatures, and coming to the finance committee is us, Comrade Dikeledi and me, just so that you know everybody gets the score right here, is actually very demanding. I got into the Finance Committee 20 years after I came to Parliament. So, in short, all I'm saying to you is, let's put it to the test. And if we fail, Dennis, you can sort us out.
I have a membership book in my office, Trey.
No way. I've been observing this thing, no poaching, and you will not succeed on that one. Listen, are you fine?
I'm fine.
Thank you. The Secretariat will process that, engage with the Standing Committee. And the PBO, thank you very much. And now we are stepping to the next item of the day, the FSC to make a presentation. May I request Honorable Njandu to come and share for a second, while I respond to Nation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I thought you were going to say, let's all respond to Nature.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I thought we will morning Chairperson, honourable members. I was really expecting us to finish before honourable Ms. Karim gets here. Unfortunately, time is not on my side this time around. I thought that listening to the questions that came from the members, but also the comments raised, and again, I think the ESCOM matter is extremely, extremely complicated. And the reason why I say that is that I'll speak to you as the chairperson of the Finance and Fiscal Commission, I also want to draw on my experiences as the chairperson of the special task team that was appointed by the cabinet to look at municipal debt to ESCOM and the ESCOM municipal debt relationship. And then there was the 13th action when I used to serve in DPME as a special advisor to the minister until 2016. The reason I'm raising that as a background point, I hope the other members will come back in time. The ESCOM issue is so complicated that we think that we understand the financials and the data and the structural configuration, the functionality, and the coal contracting, and the supply demand issues, and the costing and pricing of ESCOM, and a range of other stuff within ESCOM. The truth is nobody understands it. The truth is nobody has got access to that information. The truth is that it's probably conceivable that not even the CEO and others understand exactly the complexity of ESCOM. When I was chairing this municipal finance and ESCOM, the debt owed to ESCOM matter, it became abundantly clear that not even the Treasury knows exactly what's going on in ESCOM. That's how scary the situation is. And when we present stuff, it's presented based on what is given at the macro level. If you dig a little bit deeper, you're going to get lost into it. So this is a massive, massive institution where continuously it's at a high risk. It's at a high risk for the sovereign, it's a high risk for itself, and there are extremely huge complications around it. Financial and fiscal in particular, the economic outlook of the institution, the service delivery outlook of the institution, the governance and performance question too. And on the governance and performance question too, at the surface level, ESCOM has got three principles. And we should underestimate this, just because they're all sitting in the same cabinet and from the same political party. ESCOM has a one principle, which is the shareholder representative, the Minister of Public Enterprise. Then the other principle of ESCOM, because of the financial and fiscal matters and the economic questions around ESCOM, is the Minister of Finance. And the third principle is the policy principle on energy, which is the Minister of Mineral Resources and Energy. So you got three principles that interact with ESCOM. The chairperson's comment was that does DPME have the capacity? The history of DPME, old hands like, sorry.
Comrade Karim, you can say. experienced hands like Comrade Chair Karim, to use a demagogy slogan.
Is this from the Korean
Club? Yes. They will know that the Department of Public Enterprises was established. Its history was to privatize state-owned enterprises. Its history was not to do what it currently is doing. And in fact, one doesn't really know what it's currently doing. Because it's because of the complexity and the principle. You know, when you have a principle, you have an agent. And in a principal-agent relationship, the agent knows far more than what the principal knows. And that's why we talk about the symmetry of information. So in this instance, the shareholder department, I don't know the interventions that the Minister of Public Enterprises has done to date, but the shareholder department is not capable, the way I know it, in the years of before 2019, to actually adequately manage and monitor what's happening within an institution like ESCOM, let alone Translate, let alone the NEL, and so on and so forth. And the reason why is that to be able to monitor this institution, you need to have the same capacity. And if you don't have capacity, you cannot govern. You need to have the requisite capacity in the same way it was ESCOM has to be able to monitor ESCOM. To compound the matter is that the state-owned companies, and especially an institution like ESCOM and others, they have their own establishment legislation. You cannot look at this without looking at ESCOM's own establishment legislation, because ESCOM's establishment legislation gives the board and the CEO greater powers than what the minister has. Because the powers are quite clear in terms of who's responsible and the government is for. Yes, the Prime Minister and Cabinet are the overall shareholder, but the authority that sits within the establishment legislation suggests that there are greater powers that the board and the CEO have relative to the minister. And that comparative nature of the legislation needs to be looked at. So the DPME, the way I understand it, the way I know it, is essentially an administrative department, it's an administration. So matters comes in around government guarantees. There's a look at it, not sufficient information on it. It gets processed through the Minister of Finance, and then it gets to the finance treasury's internal finance committees to look at guarantees. That's where the stuff actually happens. Because the department, the way I understand it, till 2019, didn't have sufficient capacity. So I don't know whether the Minister of Finance is actually looking at that, because your department, relative to the huge capabilities that these institutions have, doesn't have it. And in fact, all of us together don't have it, because the financials are just the systems and the processes and the data availability. And it's amazing how the ESCOM colleagues that appeared before the special task team, advisory task team of the cabinet, before, when they were saying that they can't release information because of the competitive view. Now, how do you get how do you deal with competition in a place where you actually have the monopoly over the industry? It's quite a tricky issue. And I think only that can be resolved by the executive to relook at what is the responsibility of DPME relative to its original intention. I'm not suggesting privatization, but I'm just raising the issue around that. Because it will require, obviously, to look at what the president is saying in terms of the unbundling of ESCOM into generation, transmission, and distribution. All these things are interlinked. I thought I needed to say to on a demand and supply question that was raised clearly there's an issue around, nobody is, I don't think there was a question about whether there's an increased demand for electricity. There definitely is increased demand for electricity supply, but it's the issue of input cost to it, but also the supplier cost to it. Another input issue is what is referred to, diesel fuel, cheap coal, which is a problem to it, and essentially the reflective cost and the cost of electricity. And another reflective cost is the issue of cost to industry, cost to household, and cost to selling electricity out of the country. And there are issues, problems with the structure of that costing structure of tours. And then obviously it gets compounded by the fact that many middle class to rich to use industries are opting out of the grid. So people look at wind and solar energies. And that obviously has a dent on it. And in fact, it has a dent on municipal resources. So the issue is not about the demand of the issues about the carry through on supply costs, which is a problem, and it has an effect on ESCOM. I thought the issue around the clause 1B, which of the special appropriation, which I thought the PPO would have expressed that, because I saw that there was quite a hard talk to them about that. The only thing that they did was to reflect on what is in the appropriation. That's not their condition. Your special appropriation of ESCOM says those 3 points. So it's incumbent on the members of Parliament to check whether they agree with those 3 issues around the conditionalities, the may and the must, with regard to those conditions. just to let you know, there's been, on bailouts, there's been a number of common rescues. I mean, it's been common practice over the years. And there's been many plans. And all these are connected to turnaround. All of it. This morning at Opus 4, I was thinking, okay, now, I don't know what turnaround means any longer. Because all the turnaround strategies implemented over the years has not yielded anything. In fact, there's continuously a rescue on it. So, Che, I'm going to ask Sheng to take you through it, the slides from 1 to 14, and then I'll come back to you, please.
Okay, thank you very much. I just want to sort of follow the trend as to the previous presentation that we also considering in terms of the time for the, because we know that it's the next meeting.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, Chair, so how much time do we still have?
Now
it's 12.
Yeah, it's 12:30. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long is the presentation. We can maybe say like 12 o'clock, if it's possible.
12:15,
okay.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, all the commitments made earlier, people Chair arrived at, I'll keep it succinct. Okay, so skip aside. Going straight into just in terms of introduction and not to put too much reiteration on the what we at FFC does and aren't, is essentially, I think, as I repeated in others, the best exercise around this is to go back to the Constitution and then search for where FFC is mentioned. So next slide, just to give more information or add splash to the bone on the macro financial and fiscal information around ESCOM, the issue of this special appropriation bill in relation to ESCOM, is that not too long ago, while this bill was being put up, we experienced that dramatic downturn, right, in the first quarter of 2019. Subsequently to that, in the second quarter, we had a recovery of 3.1%,
from this terrible loss in the 3.2 downturn in the first quarter, and that was mostly because of, or a large part of that cause could be attributed to the issues at Eskom in that first quarter. So it is, I think the correlation there is quite strong. So here, essentially, this economic impact, right, of Eskom does have, to a certain extent, the impact on the fiscus, on the health of the overall economy, and therefore the revenue capability of the state, and also our credibility in the market, essentially. Okay, so next slide. I want to go now this into the fiscal impact. Honourable members and chair, remember that currently for the 2020 NTEF, essentially the budget for next year, the governments overall, both national as well as provincial, have been requested to reduce the budget by 5% for next year, and then followed by 6% in the following year, and 7% in the third year, okay, of the 2020 NTEF, okay? And I just want to say 5% reduction over of the entire fiscus of 1.5 trillion comes to about 70, 80 billion. Now, with that information in mind, let's look at the impact of the guarantees, government guarantees, in terms of how it has performed recently, right? So this here I have is the comparison between the government guarantee and exposure for the 2018-19 fiscal year, both the absolute add as well as the deviations. In other words, think of it as first we budget, right, in the first case as government guarantees, that saying that we will put up guarantees. And then at the end of the financial year, we obviously will come up with the exposure, almost like the actual expenditure, if you think about it. The deviation thereof then shows us to a degree what that the credibility or the lack of credibility thereof of the budget. Essentially, it's like you budget for something and then suddenly you blew the budget by however much, there's your deviation. So let's look at the numbers here. We can see that in particular, and in the context of this special appropriation bill, is that Eskom, right, in the 2018 budget, we almost budgeted for 235 billion or 236 billion in terms of government guarantees. By the end of that, right, we realized that we had an exposure of 294 0.7 billion. That means a deviation of 58.8 or 9 billion over exposure on that for Eskom. And then adding that up overall, all the 10 beneficiaries, top 10 beneficiaries plus others, we're looking at for just the recent financial year of 2018-19. We had an overexposure of 84 billion. With this information, as well as the first point that I raised about the NTEF reduction on the fiscus, what essentially is happening here, I think, and obviously we still need to back check this when the medium-term budget policy comes in with the amendments on the Division of Revenue Bill, which is of high relevance to this select committee. On appropriations, is that essentially government is tightening its belt to make room for these overexposures, right, from a fiscal perspective, okay? And in terms of how the budget and money is moving around within that budget, okay? So I thought that is of high relevance, in particular to this committee, given that it is to do with provinces and so on. Next slide, just to give a more sense that just how we've come to this point. As you can see, and I think it's quite interesting, that the top three, rights, which in terms of the acceleration, if you will, not the growth, but actually the acceleration of exposures, are number one, ESCOM, followed by Road Accident Fund, as well as this independent power producers. And then you can just see just how much that of just those three colors, right, the blue, red, and green, adding on, right, to the long-standing government guarantee exposures over the years. Next slide. Here is just to give members, these are all, because I attended the joint meeting, Standing Committee on Appropriation Portfolio and Select Committee on Appropriation on the 10th of September, where the Minister Pravin Gordhan, as well as CEO of ESCOM, was present to give more facts and just to give members some of the analysis thereof from that particular meeting, especially from a financial and fiscal perspective. And I shan't go too much into that because it's just a summary of that meeting. However, with the this is and this is where it comes now to start the view, or at least my personal view on this thing, is that there's been a lot of talk about the sort of the operational deficiencies or inefficiencies of ESCOM. And I think it is a worthwhile conversation to have, except that sometimes I think we forget who we are in terms of, because I'm not an engineer, and I don't think that many of us are. But just looking at the numbers, all right, here I give you the sort of the situational analysis of the energy sector, plus minus also on the just the overall financial health of the of ESCOM, and of particular interest. But let's just first go down the list of information that was presented at that engagement, right? So we have the capacity that were installed, electricity cells. If you just notice that how those changes happened across those items, revenue increased by 400% roughly, average selling price by 400, so that means that the two are driving each other, which makes sense. Coal purchases increased only by 0.8%, your coal cost increased by 485, also in line in terms of the input costs or at least the coal cost part of the input cost. Then you have the employee costs, employee numbers, and then the most significantly being the debt securities and borrowings, increased from 40 billion in 2007 to 440 billion in 2019. Of particular interest is here, let's think in terms of how the input happened and also the output happened. So, so it's of rather particular interest, right, that when you have more people working in ESCOM, right, with higher costs, right, both headcount as well as cost, and we know for a fact that, which I also have in the next page, on the primary energy cost, which we've heard earlier, increased also quite substantially. Here I have a 665% increase. And yet, the total capacity only increased by 3.5%. With all the input costs increase and the headcount and number of people working for ESCOM that increased, you only moved 0.8% more coal. That is about 1 megaton of coal purchases done, right? And you, interestingly, earlier the honourable member also raised the question: how do you have, where population increased by so much, but your electricity sales only actually decreased, right? Minus 4.5% on that. So starting to see here is really there are evidence of operational deficiency and inefficiencies of ESCOM, whereby your input cost increases, more people working in there, and then but yet your output, your coal, the amount of coal you moved, the sales that you made, and then as well as installed capacity that you installed decrease or staying relatively stagnant. So we are really, there's even from the financial side, we can start to see some of the operational deficiency that is evidently there. Next, income statement of Eskom. This is, again, of particular interest, and I heard the other day Honorable Ryder really mentioned, is that everything seems relatively sort of defensible until after EBITDA, right? EBITDA is positive, but everything seems to fall off the wheel wagon straight after that, with the interest payments which increased during this period 1,894%. And then also the investment requirement, which brought, brings us to the overall shortfall, right, that we've so frequently on the 38.9% shortfall. So, and earlier we've also heard that Parliamentary Budget Office also mentioned that a large part of the Eskom issue is a financial issue, it's a debt issue. So that it is worthwhile to look at those debt contracts, I believe, to at least see what is the portfolio on that, who and what, where, how much are we paying for, or Eskom is paying to service those debts, and the terms on those. Because remember, Honourable Members and Chair, is that during that that 10th of September 2019 meeting, the Eskom CEO actually said that he hasn't touched any of those contracts, or he can't touch it, or he can't change in the terms and conditions around that. Okay, so that is the overall the picture. I think the rest of the slides, at least until page slide 14, are pretty much saying the same thing: is the debt ratio sort of exceeding the assets of the of Eskom. As well as the overall general financial health is weakening, but the overall weakening of that is due to the hyper increase on the debt. With that, I hand over to Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, I think let me.
Sorry.
Okay.
I need to take you further.
Yes, I understand, yes. Yeah, I just want to, the chairperson has arrived, so I will to just do the following to say that, and then so we can continue. Chair, in the background of the presentation is in terms of the complexity of Eskom, the understanding of what is happening in Eskom, and also the agency in terms of knowledge, knowing more than its principal meaning, knowing more as we don't have we have little information, and for us to oversight with little information is a challenge, and also the capacity to monitor Eskom and the power which is in Eskom, which means that decisions that are taken which are not really considering in terms of what our role is as a committee. So Chairperson, I think in terms of the background and the presentation, so it will be taken forward. I will be giving over to the chairperson, because when it gets to the clarities of the members, the last thing is just the apology of Honorable Mkiva, who had to leave earlier. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. This part, we're basically talking about the details of the government support strategy, and the first point is the 2019 budget allocation gave 23 billion rand and the Eskom for the next 10 years to service its debt and meet the redemption requirements. Eskom now requires more government support to be financially sustainable and on its debt. I thought that the DPME, the public, the PBO also raised with you that the government authorized the 70 billion payment to Eskom in April 2019 through Section 16 of the Public Finance Management Act, that enables funding in emerging situations. Section 16 is quite important in terms of if this committee so wish or the other committee to address the issues around conditionalities to reflect on the internal workings of Section 16 and how a Section 16 gets evoked by the Minister of Finance. The ESCOM special appropriation consists of additional funding of 26 billion in 2019-20, 33 billion in 2020-21 financial year. We believe that there is a crisis, and obviously there's a need to intervene against the negative economic growth. We think that, just go to the next slide please. We think that ESCOM's special appropriation will result in a widening of the budget deficit, especially considering also that poor economic growth will result in revenue under collection. There is an element of fiscal consolidation that needs to be considered in terms of the government's fiscal policy trajectory for the next couple of years, but there's also obviously an impact on other spending departments. We have the view that fiscal consolidation policy approach also needs to be part of the overall bill over ESCOM. ESCOM bailout will also result. Taken together, the above points imply that the bailout will further put South Africa's investment status at risk of a downgrade, causing further liquidity challenges. The above worrisome situation will be compounded by the fact that the bailout is not anchored in a sound and implementable plan or strategy to get ESCOM out of the doldrums and onto a sustainable growth path. Here the point is that it is probably conceivable that if the conditionalities becomes explicit, that it could be linked to the approach that the President articulated of the unbundling of ESCOM. And both in the conditionalities, the issue around generation, transmission, and distribution to it, but also with greater content to what does it mean. The next slide, the Commission is also concerned about the deployment of the Chief Restructuring Officer to change ESCOM. There are lots of locked-in contracts, the possible pushback and resistance to change from existing governance and human infrastructure may derail efforts of the CRO. We have the view that the ESCOM bailout does crowd out other infrastructure investments. Given that the nature of the bailout, we need to be aware of the unproductive government spending. This means that there will be reprioritization of cuts and other fiscal expenditures, social services in particular, which could negatively affect service delivery. There is a need to increase the whole conversation around financial governance space, especially when it relates to this institution. But one will also want to draw the need to find a resolve in terms of conditionalities, if so wish by this committee, which we'll advise, as to what will be the role of the Minister of Finance in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, in terms of the special appropriation, what will be the Minister of Public Enterprises in this, and also what will be the role of the Minister of Mineral Resources and Energy. We think that because it's a joint-up government issue in many ways, it's a government-wide matter in many ways, that it's probably conceivable to look at what will be the role of the three principals in this. And on top of that, what will be the role of the different administrations within this? Because the bailout is in terms of the total government guarantees used is around 350. And then there's also the cash that comes with this with this new bailout. So there's a need to look at the issues of risk. The issue around conditions and conditionalities, our view is that the conditions over the years has been soft, has not been properly appropriated, and it needs to be explicit to allow degrees of sustainability, but also to allow transparency around it. So there needs to be harder conditions on it. The Commission proposes the following operational actions for ESCOM: reducing the cost of the current and additional ABP contracts, cost of transporting coal as well as cost associated with coal specification in the national, in the international markets. The issue is also we're not really sure what other IPP contracts are in the pipeline. So it's again back to my initial point that I made, that this is a huge institution. Information is hard to come by. You've seen yourself over the years that the audit of financial statements sometimes gets produced 6 months to 8 months to a year after the financial year. And it's because of the complexity of the financial data within this institution and non-financial data. The need for diversification in alternative energy generation, acceleration of deferred infrastructure maintenance programs needs to be considered, the acceleration of the outsourcing of non-core services. There's a need to speed up the recruitment of a permanent CEO. We are concerned that the chairperson is also the CEO because it creates issues of governance. As we've mentioned in the Standing Committee on Appropriation. And Chair, I'm sorry I'm rushing through it because I thought some of your members were also in that meeting with the Standing Committee on Appropriation on it. And there needs to be clarity as to what is going to be the role of the Chief Restructuring Officer and the capacity in the Chief Restructuring Officer's office relative to that of the CEO. And I think given the value of the funds that's been given over years, it is conceivable to bulk in these as part of the conditionalities to be done. In fact, our view would be that the special appropriation must be tabled with new conditions, not post facto. Must be tabled when Parliament, both houses of Parliament, considers the special appropriations. The conditionalities also need to be tabled with it, which makes it binding post the period. And obviously leaving the leeway to all three ministers to add conditionalities which are open and transparent and yet communicated to Parliament at different periods within the parliamentary process of this. There's a need for greater clarity and predictability in the future of government financial support from ESCOM to enhance future financial planning. The issue here is as simple as can be, is that you can't have an institution asking every year for a government guarantee or special appropriation or bailout without even evaluating what has happened to the previous ones. So it's like a compounding question of supply of bailout support without evaluating really what are the real benefits that previous bailout has yielded to the fiscus, to the energy sector, but also to the public interest and the fiscus. We also propose that the appropriation needs to consider a performance management framework, a Parliament linking a turnaround to deliverables, much more concretely what are those deliverables that will yield changes in the performance of ESCOM, and it has to consider also the ESCOM executive and non-executive pay and performance contracts. There has been concerns expressed over time that internally ESCOM is the management and staff have greater control over policies and processes and systems inside Eskom relative to the shareholder, which is the cabinet on behalf of the people of the country. And as a result, some of the things are quite obscure in terms of looking at the performance of this institution. So there also needs to be clear performance areas with specific timeframes set to amend this slide by the National Treasury for Eskom Chief Restructuring Officer, but we want to add also the other two ministers, the Minister of Public Enterprises, who is the shareholder, the sole shareholder representative, and also by the Minister of Mineral Resources and Energy. The point that we're making is that this is not only about Eskom, it's also about the industry. And it's also about the citizens. So we can't have this solo mentality around the appropriation. It has to do that joint up government-wide intervention into this matter, so that when the appropriation committees deal with the monitoring and the oversight and the accountability on this special appropriation, it manages to call in all three executives, executive authorities, into this matter. And to quote Comrade Yunus Karim, member Yunus Karim, is that, I don't know why I said that, I must call him Comrade, but let me call him Comrade, is that this can't be a chairperson, this can't be an executive-driven monitoring and oversight. It has to be embedded within the processes of Parliament, given the risk that the 350 billion, including this, is raising to the sovereign. If there's a failure to payment, the loans will be called. We will see it dipping beyond junk status. There will be a fiscal and economic crisis in the country, and this will be almost like the end of South Africa's own sovereignty. And we need to protect the sovereign. So it can't be driven by the executive in terms of its monitoring. So Parliament needs to carve out its role in this one. The risks are too high. So it can't be this flimsy oversight stuff that gets done in Parliament. I'm sorry I'm mentioning it, but I'm getting woke up. It's that departments come and they present documents, and they give information, and questions get asked, and members of Parliament just leaves, and it's fine, and the report gets written. And then the media gets in first on accountability before Parliament got into accountability matters. So I'm saying that Parliament has to sort out the performance management framework. Parliament has to insist on the legislative and regulatory frameworks around this. And especially built into the conditional grants framework. Parliament has to really look at the issues of oversight and accountability. It can't just be about slight reports and that's it. There has to be harder questions, which probably includes a different form of oversight versus it gets done where other questions can be asked. Jointly or committees on their own. And there needs to be an increase in the capacity in this. And I note Honourable Karim's point about joint meetings and research. I think the research capacity and the content capacity is not at the level where it needs to happen. And it's probably conceivable that going forward in this, and given the risk that I want to state, but I can't decide for them, is that it's probably conceivable that the researchers and the content advisors, the PBO, the Finance and Fiscal Commission, work together to help this committee and the standing committee to adequately get sets of information around this. And it can't be the situation where parliamentary staff say that, yeah, but it's a mandate script. It can't be a mandate script issue. sovereign is at risk. So we need to look beyond our own overzealous protection of our mandates and the boundaries, and to help Parliament think through this. So the detailed legislative regulatory framework must clearly stipulate the timelines for unbundling into the separate units of generation and transmission, and we think that to increase the ante on monitoring and accountability, this is to be built as part of the conditionalities. In fact, there's a classic example, Chairperson, in the previous finance committee, the last term's finance committee, where the Auditor General and the committee itself dealt with the amendments on the public audit legislation on the audit committee on the Auditor General, and this is a classic example where the experience of that finance committee can, in terms of how it dealt with the Public Audit Amendments Act, can deal with what ought to be the conditionalities. Given the high levels of inefficiency at ESCOM, there is this whole thing about a need to look at what is. You have a greater chance as members of Parliament to ask ESCOM what is this comparative competitive information that cannot be released to organs of state, also to the executive branch and to Parliament, given that you have the monopoly over the industry. It's quite a question that puzzles everybody around that. Chair, then there are issues around tariff disparities, and I've raised it in the beginning. There is the issue about the industry and mining sector together with consume 60% of electricity produced in the country, and residential consumers consume about between 16 to 18. There's a huge inequity. It has been raised before that households pay more for electricity than industries. And the question is, do you want to increase the electricity tariffs on industries? And how is that? What's the net effect of that going to be on the economy and employment? There is the issue of debt owned by municipalities in ESCOM. There are problems around that. The committees will probably hear soon from us about institutions, the municipalities are Maluti, Apafungi in the Free State. In fact, the Free State municipalities owns the most to ESCOM. But you have a situation, there's historic debt from apartheid, debt from restructuring, debt from amalgamation, that sits in the municipalities. But you also have this thing that, because of the performance management system in ESCOM, that the managers, middle managers, make sure there's debt repayment agreement with municipalities, knowingly that the municipalities can't pay the debt. A municipality like Maluti Apafungi's budget is 1.8 billion. It's a deficit budget. They need to pay ESCOM around 200 to 300 million rand. They can't pay that back, no matter what you do. Those municipalities just don't have the fiscal capabilities to repay and the debt. We would like to then underscore to you, Honourable Chairperson, the importance of signing an implementation plan with accountable targets. And I think there needs to be interrogation about what turnaround historically meant. The reason why I'm raising the historic question is that even though it's a sixth parliament, there's an ongoing concern, and that's been recognized here. There's an ongoing contingent liability that's also been recognized. So you cannot not look at what were the other special appropriations, the government guarantees, and how does it have an impact on the current one, the new one that needs to be appropriated. So we remain concerned about the financial, operational, technical deficiencies plaguing ESCOM, and eager still to learn of a clear plan strategy to improve the viability of ESCOM and return to profitability. Even the whole question of profitability was questioned 5 years ago, whether ESCOM is a profit in ESCOM. So the issue here is that, in conclusion, I want to say, Chair, that this appropriation, relative to other appropriation, relative to the contingent liabilities and the government guarantees, is quite a different matter. It's no longer this talk about the risk to the sovereign. It's no longer about talking about the risk to the fiscus and doing a umaraba-raba to be able to bail out the ESCOM. This is of national and public interest, and there needs to be much more rigid conditions to it, no longer the soft conditions. And our view, these conditions need to be part of the appropriation bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation. A little bit depressing for me. But that's the reality that we're facing. And thank you for being so frank and open with us. It will only benefit the end users and our constituents, the citizens of South Africa. Can I acknowledge members, Honorable Ryder and Honorable Curry, in that order?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, as usual, to the FFC for a comprehensive presentation. I'm not really sure about questions. I think maybe it's more clarity, so let's shoot. Okay, so I think slide 9 is perhaps where I want to start. Specifically bullet point 3, where it indicates that there's 19.8 billion owed by municipalities. The chairperson has also just mentioned it now. It's followed quickly by a comment that the majority of that, or almost all of it, is not recognizable as revenue, in other words, not recoverable. Understanding that there are different rules of prescription around debt to an entity like ESCOM, I'm just wondering, if we had to apply normal accounting practices here, I think this would hurt the current ratios considerably more and put us in an even worse position. If you can, I suppose unfair to ask you if there's a plan to be doing something like that, but I think that I think what you're saying there is that it is actually desirable to do that and get rid of the history and clean it up and move on. I think that slide 10 is providing a reasonably good idea of where the problems lie. I don't think we need to delve too much into that. Slide 13, and I think you're dealing with the NAV there, and again, from 2014 to 2019. I'd be particularly interested to see these details going back from 2009, if not 2007. So the previous slide that I just referenced was 2007 to 2019, and I think that 2007 was where we started with the load shedding. That was where the president at the time, Becky, indicated initially that there's a need to re-energize ESCOM, and I think that's where the mandate was given to throw money at the problem. That's where the 60 billion appropriation that we can get an adequate answer on earlier on started. So in terms of looking at it from, I think a view from 2009 would have been more helpful there. And I know I asked for these things yesterday too from a different crowd, but I think that we're looking at this problem in too narrow a snapshot. and it would help us a lot better if we could see a broader view of where we've come from, so that we can get our heads around, you know, what's been achieved by the taking on of all this additional debt which has ballooned, and what hasn't been taken on. Because I think Eskom yesterday gave us an indication of some of the projects that they've undertaken. The fact is that those projects, as are shown in the table on slide 10, all that they've done is they've managed to keep the lights on, and there hasn't been additional capacity necessarily created in spite of the IPPs. And that might be my question on slide 10, is that installed capacity, does that include the IPPs that you're referencing on slide 10? Then to go to the chairperson's comments about soft conditions, the need for transparency, the need for consequences, etc. And I think slide 19, the last bullet, need to watch the financial governance space very carefully through parliamentary oversight. There were comments about binding conditions. There were comments about needing to make the conditions part of the appropriation. And I want to echo that quite strongly and say that this time round there needs to be proper monitoring. I also want to flag the issue that I don't believe that Parliament has capacity as it stands now. Now, I know that in February of this year, the President mandated the Deputy President to head up an interministerial squad almost of people which would have some sort of oversight over this. And that's from an executive point of view. I do think that the issue is that Parliament needs to be better capacitated, and I'm not sure exactly how to do that. I don't believe that the PBO and the researchers have the capacity as they stand right now, even if they work together. But in terms of the report backs, I think you said an oversight framework of Eskom as by an ad hoc committee of Parliament entailing quarterly reports outlining milestones, massively important, particularly with the conditions that we're going to put in place, which need to be binding, which need to have proper consequences. And I think that's the point where we're all in agreement, and Honourable Karim was talking about how much in agreement we are, and I think we're all in agreement that we've got to a stage where we understand where we are. We don't necessarily understand how we got here, but we do understand that we need to put conditions on what we're doing, and bringing those in is obviously important, hence the need for what we've now decided is going to be a joint discussion. But those conditions are going to be absolutely key to taking this thing forward. But they need to be monitored, and I do want to make that point here quite carefully. Issues around governance were noted with King 2 and 3. Your concluding three slides kind of give some hints towards some issues within Eskom that need attention, and I'm not sure if these need to be, if all of them even need to be included in a discussion about conditions necessarily, but I think that they do need to be taken note of, and certainly by Eskom. Things like tariff disparities, etc., etc., and in terms of modelling going forward. I do know that the CRO has promised us some responses to some of these, and we're expecting a white paper from Eskom in the next month or so, and that might answer some of these issues. But I would have liked some sort of a hint from the FFC in terms of what kind of conditions they might, you know, be suggesting or guiding us towards. I think that's something that we certainly have room to ask for, because I think at this stage, all hands on deck, as you say, our sovereignty is under threat, and any advice is going to be well accepted. So perhaps a request then, maybe guide us a little bit on where we should be looking in terms of conditions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable
Vida. Honourable Karim? Yeah, just very quickly. Firstly, I had no idea. I chaired the Public Enterprises Committee for 2.5 years. I had no idea that the Law Establishment Act gives ESCOM CEO and board chair more power than the minister. That's quite a surprise. But be that as it may, in effect, I don't think the board, I don't know, has ever thrown that back at a minister or, you know, maybe a DG, but not a minister. And I don't think it's something we need to put immediately on the agenda. I hear what the FFC is saying. Down the road, maybe, but right now we've got other issues. If only the board, and I know Jabu Mabuza, many of us do, was being like recalcitrant and throwing the law at the minister, then we can consider amending it. But for now, I think that's not an issue. I'm sure the FFC also agrees. Secondly, I think it is a bleak picture, but that's the job of the FFC. And our job, I mean, it's human to get, like, cowed, or not cowed, but, I mean, demoralized almost, it's human. But that's all the more reason why we should fight back. And this is a fight back that should be a fight back, not a fight back you and I are used to. A real fight back, for the interests of the public, the state, the masses out there. So we shouldn't give in, and we'll thank the FFC for being so honest, frank about it, and that's their job. That's what the Constitution enjoins them to do. They're not here to suck up to Parliament or the executive. Thirdly, I think that what's unusual in this case, and sometimes I've had quibbles, as my good friend there knows, with the FFC because it doesn't give us concrete proposals. This is the one time they have, actually. They literally have measures to improve ESCOM sustainability. They actually have even gone to the extent, which I think is good. Can I encourage you, Dr. Polakis, continue to this. You're actually telling us what you think Parliament should do. That's your right. It's for us to decide whether we accept it or not. So some of the things they say, I think, consistent with what we've been saying, and I'm probably likely to do. Some of it, it seems to me, is not something we should do at this stage, not that it's ruled out altogether. So, I mean, like, if you look at their slide 21, they talk about reducing the cost of current and additional IPP contracts. I would imagine, we haven't made a final decision, Chairperson, but members will think about that. That's fine. We raised this thing before, the alliance structure. So why is ESCOM not involved itself in the IPP? Originally, they might have needed the capital, but right now, given the cost it's accumulating for ESCOM, why doesn't ESCOM itself get involved? It would be cheaper for it to do so. Plus, that is our goal in terms of our commitments to global structures and emissions and so on. I mean, this thing of non-core services and non-core assets, provided to be clear about what non-core is, Chairperson, I think this is something we should really push the Public Enterprises Committee and ourselves to extend appropriations we have any role at all to get this thing going. This is really something we can do quickly, really, and engage with the unions in that regard, but we have to do it in the union's own interest. Otherwise, jobs are going to disappear, not because of their own members. Then on the permanent CEO, and we also raised these issues yesterday. The answers we got were a bit woolly, but essentially it was that there isn't a big issue at the moment. And it's not just one individual, it's actually a team, an office. Clarity, yeah, we agree. Right-sizing of staff, yeah, we agree, but engagement with the unions, the qualification. Then there is this performance management framework. In a way, that's what's going to happen in this bill, at least in the report. You can't put a performance management framework easily into an act. But what we could do is put some pointers to that, and we can, in the report to Parliament, say this is what we expect. So on that, Comrade Chair, the one challenge we're going to have is to frighten people away. Personally, I think this should apply even to members of Parliament. If we don't work a minimum of 8 hours a day, we should get our salaries stopped. That's my view. Nobody agrees with me, and everybody will get angry with me, but that's fine. That's my view. You're really going to chop my head off. What are you going to do to me at 63? What are you going to do to me? What can you do to me after 47 years in this government? Nothing. So I'm saying it again, that actually it should apply just as much to us, Dr. Plyke, as to others we like to impose it on. our councillors, you know, that's when the issue first arose. And I said, what about us MPs in 2002? And they all looked like I'm talking a Greek language or something. Meanwhile, we were asking councillors to have performance, particularly a chairperson. And then I said, hey, colleagues, what about us? And then everybody shrank away from it. Okay, so on the matter of ESCOM executive and non-executive pay and performance contracts, in principle, yes, right? But hell, man, we battled these people, good people. So I'm not sure. I agree in principle and morally. I don't think it's practicable. On key performance areas and time frames, agreed. An oversight framework by ESCOM. Now, this ad hoc committee, I know what you're trying to mean, Dr. Clarke, but you know full well how difficult Parliament is. Where's the public enterprises NCOP committee? They're not here. They should be here at every meeting. Getting them here. Remember, there's three different committees. It's like even the secretary, Luba Balo, is shaking his head, right? Will you check whether it's appropriate for a committee secretary to get politically involved, but that you can discuss. I'm teasing you, Luba Balo. No, you know, the secretaries get dumped with a task, right? Hey, getting the Oscar. It took us 6 months, Dr. Planky, to tell you the world we come from. 6 months, where we dealt with a committee that itself requested the PBO. I think he was not here then. PBO to do a project. The PBO said, no, we only take it from four committees, I think, you know. So then we said, okay, we agree with it. It took that committee, took me 9 attempts as a committee chair to get that committee to come to me. They wanted this thing, but it has to be tabled to our committee. 9 attempts. I won't count the phone calls, the SMSs, and the WhatsApps. And how many replies, not a single one, until I accosted the person concerned in a half each time. It's not going to work. Ideally, you're right. We don't need an ad hoc committee because we can't do it. Yes, we need it. We can't do it. I think strongly we should not accept this one, with due respect to the FSC. What we are supposed to be doing is getting and persuading the public enterprise, the NCOP committee, and on that side, to actually work with us on this thing. Because ultimately, there are roles. We cannot play chairperson. You're the chair of the appropriations committee. You have a million things to do. It's for the public enterprise, the NCOP committee, to do these things. More than us, and together with us. So on performance indicators, yeah, ideally, if we were a parliament in Switzerland, not here, we're not ready for that. We can do it, but who's going to monitor it and implement it? We're not ready for that. That's correct. But we're a middle-level country. We're an emerging democracy. Look what's happening this week. People are flying back from all the provinces to turn up here. Yet this could have been done last week, actually, given the importance of this matter. We could have convened both houses last Thursday. This is us, 26 years later. We mustn't fold our arms and deny that what's happening this afternoon could have been done last week. It's hugely, hugely problematic that we can't pull things together. In any case, now this is something that I think this is over regulatory reach. See, the suggestion that legislative and the Department of Energy timelines, it's actually policy papers, IRP, they can't even get it together. When was it done? Over 10 years they battled to get the IRP. Right? I think the FFC is forgetting. They're right to be tough. But I think they're switching from, you know, thinking they're in Japan 10 years ago, or Germany. Right? I mean, which other country can do these things, right? I mean, really. So I agree with everything. Philosophically, hell, well, I wish we were there. Then clearly you and I can go and loll around on the beach, separately, of course. But we could, right? Before people see all... I'm the chairperson of Mbongi, and she's my Mbongi, right? That's our memorandum of understanding. So I really think, again, FSC, you're right, but not doable in my view. Maybe others disagree. Now, this is a great one. A detailed legislative and regulatory framework of timelines and responsibilities. I mean, the FSC, again, it's delicate negotiations with trade unions who, depending on their social base, and depending on how other union federations are flexing their muscles. Let's take our trade union, COSATU, right? We've been through this on that matter that, remember, I said this last week in a different forum. You see, it's simple. If COSATU is classed, it doesn't have a social base, NUM is sort of like frazzled and frayed, they might settle. But if they see other unions making a lot of noise in the, let's say, SUBTU or urban gyms there again, yeah, solidarity images, right. Then they might take a different tack. So you can't regulate for these things. actually you should be pleading for negotiations. Unless we get the trade unions and particularly the NUM and COSATU to have a buy-in, and AMCU is very powerful. Unless you get a buy-in from them, we're heading for a storm because of the thousands of jobs we're losing already in the mining industry. So what I'm saying is that in theory they're right, but there's too much of regulatory and legislative solutions to what are actual problems of negotiations and will and speed. My own sense is from playing other roles, the unions are much more conciliatory than most of us imagine. They understand the score of the senior leadership. They know that if there's no settlement with government and ESCOM management, we're all sinking, not least themselves. There is no alternative but restructuring. The terms of the restructuring have to be negotiated. Then, I won't carry on again for too long, but I think you get the drift, that actually they are right to identify the problems, and they've been very good. They must do this more often. They're right even to offer recommendations to us. We must take that into account, but apply it to our particular terrain and the balance of forces, as we say.
Thank you very much, honorable members. And let me also thank you for the presentation. That you were very frank and you were highlighted on the issue, that also members appreciated. The issue of the CEO, having a CEO as of the board acting as a, I mean, the chairperson of the board acting as a CEO, was raised it last week in a meeting with the Minister of DPE and other stakeholders. Yesterday we have raised it again, and we have received a report that the process has already started. They are towards finalizing the process in as far as appointing the CEO is concerned. We are going to, the matter is not about Mr. Mabuza as a person, is about the governance of the institution. On slide 6, the FSC speaks about the fact that ESCOM overspent on this original government guarantee of 235.8 billion, right, by 58.9 billion, exposed the forecast to 294.7 billion, right. Then my question will be, what were the main cost drivers that led to such exposure? And how can this be rectified going forward? I'm asking this question with the understanding that you were able to diagnose this issue, and with the expertise that you have, and the responsibility that you have just confirmed, that we cannot relegate our responsibility to the executive alone. We have a role to play. You cannot. For us, we have been saying this over and over again. We have made resolutions and recommendations as a committee as we were engaging. And it's said for us to approve this special bill. The checks and balances are often important. They are important ingredients to our work. And therefore, what is the view of the FSC? I know you have hinted on the issue of the strengthening the capacity of the Department of Public Enterprise for the oversight of the SOCs overall and their performance. So in particular I'm talking to the ESCOM matter, which we all agree that is a critical entity
to the economy and the life of the country, and also to the job creation, that the job creation and economic growth, which is the part of the 7 priorities that the president has pronounced. So given the high level of unpaid amount by some municipalities, we have spoken about the first stage. And as you were speaking, I just thought, in another engagement and the debate that we had in the SCOP, the impression that one had, of which this engagement will empower me and also assist me together with my colleagues here, my comrades, we thought the huge problem is in Soweto. The highest is in Soweto. And the Deputy President, when he was asked questions, he made a certain call to us as public reps to go and talk to our constituencies, because of course we take responsibility to a certain extent, but to some of us who have been active in the years where we were fighting the system, that the agenda has now changed. We have to take responsibility. The agenda is not to make sure that the government of the day is not surviving. The opposite is the agenda. We have to make sure that the government of the day does survive. So the issue of the municipalities, we take that very serious, that the municipalities have a contribution to a certain extent in the EXCOM problems and the balance sheet. But the follow-up question from me to you is, what is the impact of the money owed by the private companies to EXCOM, if any, and how should this be addressed? Because I want to believe that the problem or the contributor to the problem is not only public sector. And in most cases, we focus on public sector and not focus on private sector. On slide 17, you are making a point that this special appropriation bill sends a positive signal. Invest that government is committed to resolving the energy crisis. That slide at the bottom there, negative, something about negative, on the negative side, the 59 billion bailout will compound South Africa's fiscal risk, the risk today. But I'm more concerned about the market response. Maybe your input also to help us, while we do oversight, we contribute and give advices and assist the DPE as a department, but also the entity, and which will assist other entities to learn from that exercise, to have a sustainable entity. And I want to take the question that you're raising, that the issue of relying on borrowing, it pushes us, or it will cause us to lose our sovereignty as a country. And I'm agreeing with that. And that shows the importance of the intervention that we're trying to make and trying to understand the condition at which we want to get into the space. My other question is, what is the impact of the cost of the IPPs? Yesterday we raised this question. The cost of the IPPs in the overall production cost and the current debt versus its capacity, which produce only 5%. I also asked this question to PBO. And according to your observation on slide 14, you're saying ESCOM is increasingly financing its operations through debt, the sovereignty part that we are likely to lose. I'll further ask that, is ESCOM personal expenditure beginning to impact on the bailout that government is giving to ESCOM? Or ESCOM is still able to pay this from its own coffers of their revenue collection, while we understand the challenges in terms of their revenue collection? And how does the FFC see, or how can FFC advise the committee together with all the stakeholders, the role players, in terms of strengthening to improve the spending efficiency and turn around the situation? With this question, I'm trying to push you towards the condition, because the conditions will help us. But there are things that we will put in the bill. There are things that will reflect in the condition that will talk to the bill. There are things that, as Honorable Karim said, we can't put them in the bill, but they'll have to be in the report. We'll have to speak to them in the report. And honorable members and the team from the FSC, we have had engagement. In this process that we engaged the different stakeholders, there are resolutions or recommendations, not resolution yet, because we still have to tighten them up. We have recommendations that we have taken. It must not be seen that we are just doing for compliance sake. We still remember what we have recommended. And allow me just to highlight just a few. This committee made the point that the special paper on ESCOM needs to be published should not only be presented before the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprise, but that Appropriations Committee, the Select Committee on Appropriation and Spending Committee on Appropriation should be part of the process. That we have emphasized, and that's the expectation. We have also expressed a need to convene quarterly or biannual joint meetings with the Portfolio Committee on public enterprise. I think Honorable Karim has emphasized the difficulty of doing that. But this is something that we have resolved and we are committed to doing it. Because even at the strategic plan, we have, as a committee, we have emphasized the importance of the intergovernmental relations. We have to work together. And in that way, I think there will be progress in what we are doing. Both houses were taking your comments serious, and I appreciate what you're saying, to say Parliament. And Parliament, when you talk about Parliament, you talk about the two houses, needs to take seriously their oversight role and not expect only the executive to to be the ones who the ones who are supposed to do the oversight. And we were of the view that there was a need to underscore the implementation of necessary consequence management. The consequence management, remember when we met with the minister last week again, is it last week? Yes. We were part of the meeting and all other stakeholders, the unions, the consequence management, we know the unions in the workplace, the interest is the condition and the interest of their workers. But also unions have code of conduct. And consequence management is expected, and they need to understand that. We are where we are because there's no consequence management. We only hear things through the Zondo Commission that things happen. And it's not only us, the public has that. And we want to say, as the committee, whoever is implicated, let the law take its course. There should be accountability, and accountability is not about a shy scrap to from. Who allows a shy scrap to pay? The law needs to be respected and be enforced. We also said lastly, as a committee, that we were of the view that there was a need for parliamentary committees to start following up on their recommendations with each and every government entity, especially those that have received government bailouts, such as from SAA, SA Express, SAPO, SABC, and others. The tracking system on our resolution. That's what we're going to do. Even today's meeting, whatever we recommend, we're going to track down on what we have discussed. Come the next meeting that we have with you, we're not going to start there as if nothing has happened, we start afresh. We'll have to check where we have ended. We used to call it matters arising. That's from what we have resolved on and check if we have implemented and look at the way forward. With that, I would like to give to the FSC and please let's consider time is now 12:36. We should be done and allow members to have lunch, and 2 o'clock we must be seated in the house. Thank you very much.
Chair, can I just raise one issue?
Okay.
Given the thousands of questions we've raised, they're not going to be able to answer in the 20 minutes or so left, right? So maybe what they can do is give us fuller answers in writing. That's one option. But they must cover. Secondly, I was about to send you a note. I've got another meeting, party political structure I must go to. So I'm going to leave at 12:45. But I'll catch up, you know. I'll discuss with you and Pilalani what came out of this. Thank you.
Honorable Ryan.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm largely in agreement, and I think that my biggest question remains around the fact that we'd like some guidance on the conditions. And perhaps then the FFC could also be invited to a joint meeting in future as well to perhaps give some guidance on that. Just a recommendation.
What joint meeting? The
one on conditions.
Okay.
I don't understand what you mean conditions. They have given us their conditions. Is he wanting more? They put down very clearly measures to improve, and then they've Commission's proposed measures, and they've given us concrete proposals. Maybe they can add, but they are there.
I don't think this matter needs a debate. It's not going to make any difference whether they are there or they are not. They've given us their view. We have commented on what they've given us. They've heard us. If they still want to make additions like you're proposing on what they have they have presented or based on what we have said or commented on, they can still write.
Yeah.
And nothing stops them from being part of the meeting to hear us. There's no harm in that. Can you, Prof, just summarize as per the request of the members? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I'll try to be quick. The beauty of Parliament is that when parliamentarians say something, you can always throw it back at them, including the President. The President indicated in the State of the Nation address that Parliament will have to up its role in terms of accountability of the executive. So that's the first thing. The second point, Chair, is that a honourable chairperson of a committee spoke in of a finance committee, the Standing Committee of Finance was saying in the National Assembly very clearly to the Minister of Finance that, Minister, you're giving us too many things to work on. We can't have a parliament that's executive driven, driven by the executive in terms of our role. It needs to be parliament driven in terms of its processes and stuff. That was in 2017, Minister Chairperson Yunus Karim. And then the current chairperson was saying some time ago, also in the same fifth parliament, that there's a need to increase the clear guidelines as to how parliament committees need to keep the executive, but in particular state-owned companies, accountable in terms of their performance. So that's the nice thing about research. You can always do triangulation and throw things back as part of the record. Now, I think what I want to say is that to all the members of Parliament, comrades, and it goes across the party, comrades from across the party in this process, party lines, is that once upon a time we were warriors. Now we've become reformers. And part of it is, what do we want to achieve through the special appropriation of ESCOM? What do we want to achieve through that? And how are we going to get there? And part of that achievement is to protect the sovereign. The second part of that achievement is to ensure prudent financial and fiscal sustainability and governance as it comes to ESCOM and all the other state-owned enterprises. The third thing is that we want an efficient, cost-effective and reflective electricity supply to citizens and to the industry that will make the economy work and become unreliable. That's what we want to achieve. Now, clearly, the thing is that we were also saying at a certain time that some of these things can't be done because of the systems that we have. If you look 25 years back, apartheid is off our legislative books, constitution, we got a new government, we got a new systems in place, and there are huge challenges. So things can be done. The reason why we've recommended, and I get the point on the oversight framework for ESCOM and our committee, it's less about the committee. It's more about how do we ensure and advise Parliament to have a focused, unfettered, concentrated attention on ESCOM, contingent liabilities, government guarantees, and the whole process of bailout and special appropriation. That's the key point. How you do it, whether you want to do an ad hoc or no ad hoc, is neither here or there. This is so big. We can't let it go. I remember when I was helping the chief administrator setting up South African Social Security Agency in those 2 years. We were disappointed that one of the committees that manages 400 billion rands a year over a two-year period was one of the weakest committees in Parliament at the time, talking some years back now. And that social ground system is a high risk, political risk, some spending risk, and to the fiscus. And the questions that were asked was mediocre by members of parliament. Did my people in my community get grants or not?
That wasn't the issue. The issue is what were the social benefits that was yielded to the fiscus and to the citizens of Africa around that. That's the key thing here. So part of the issue is, and I get the point about regulatory frameworks, but here's the point, honourable members. Parliament get measured, all parliament gets measured by its outputs in terms of legislation and regulatory framework. You are lawmakers. I'm using that in a way that we some of us know each other for more than 20, 30 years. We're not sitting in the advice office anymore. Or Ratepayers Association anymore. This is Parliament. You're the lawmakers. You're the regulatory confirmation people that serves on behalf of the public representatives. And part of your tools to monitoring oversight and accountability is the law. Compliance, checking the efficiency questions within the law, making sure it yields the necessary national interest results to the system. And on the one hand, what we're saying is that if you don't have these conditionalities built into the appropriation, you're going to have the same appropriation that you've had over the years. And then we're going to have the same problem where we lament and we argue and we say this thing is at a high risk. You don't have an element of where you can keep the CEO properly accountable, the board properly accountable, and so on and so forth. So I wanna suggest, Chair, that there are three things that I would like to say before Honourable Karim leaves. One is that we need to strengthen institutional arrangements on government guarantees, bailouts, and contingency liability. How we do it? We're giving some of the measurements to do that. Two, we need to start looking at strengthening the link between government guarantees, management framework, and oversight of SOEs. We need to do that. We got three pieces of legislation, PFMA, company law, and the establishment legislation of the institution. Three pieces of legislation. And all three of those pieces of legislation. And yes, Honorable Karim, you're right. Previously, you didn't look at the way that the challenges are now. But if you look at it, the scales are more in favor of the internal governance of the institution relative to the shareholder. And we need to change that. And the shareholder has got the greater authority in terms of what these state-owned enterprises are doing. And not this thing that we continuously... we always use the Chinese example, but the Chinese example is not this distant thing. It's like a closeness to it. So that there's adequate monitoring continuously that the citizens and the government don't feel the heat when things go wrong. The third thing that I thought was important is that part of the putting going forward is to develop an institutional requirements. There's a need to integrate decisions on government guarantees with the budget. That's one part of our problem with the budget, because sometimes because we want to rescue, because the risks are too high, some of these things happen off budget and the cabinet gets squeezed into a point where they damn if they do and they damn if they don't. And we're saying that a regulatory framework has to be considered in terms of how to create stability in the system, how to create predictability. Now, all of us that works in finance and economics and in policy and governance, we want to see stability. We want to see predictability. And that's the idea that we're pushing through this. On all the others, Chair, I think, correctly so, we will come back. We will amend our narrative, and then we'll circulate this. We'll look at it. Because the issue of political interference every time comes up, I'm of the view that, so what? As long as the political interference is based on the rules, and the rules are transparent, and the rules have got to do with improving the governance of the institution. In our situation, it's a problem. It raises question about who is actually in charge. And it's a real issue. I've sat in these meetings where the truth is that if you look at the scale of what the scale in terms of the governance question, the authority around the operations, and the operations is the big issue. It's where money gets spent, money gets invested, it's where the distribution happens, and so on and so forth. And this is not an ESCOM matter. It cuts across all the SOEs. And the point I'm making is that yes, the minister is the shareholder. Yes, the cabinet is the shareholder. But no, there is a problem as who is actually in charge. And it is the authority of the CEO and is the authority of the board. Because the minister can't get things done if he or she doesn't interact with the board. And if you have a recalcitrant board chairperson, which is not in this case, you can do whatever you want to do. There are governance rules. They will pull for you King 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They'll pull for you the company's law, they'll pull for you the PFMA, and they'll pull the establishment information. It's not ESCOM. It's how the whole state-owned enterprises legislative framework is operating. So that needs to be looked at. So some of the conditionalities is in there. Others we will think through. I'm going to have to speak to our colleagues in the PBO so that we look at how we can work together on this if they want to, but it's part of that stuff that we need to do. For us, it's we're not suggesting we must create a new state of New York here or city of New York where everything, if you stand in a window with an open chest, they can charge you for exposure. No, we're not talking about that. We're talking about there are three things within institutions, Chairperson. The one thing is an institution is about the rule of law. The second thing of an institution is about people and leadership. And the third thing about the institution is about systems. We are saying we're at risk. We're at risk, and there needs to be intervention. And this is huge. This is used, 350 used out of 400 Berlin Rand government guarantees, and on top of it you've got the other guarantees, you've got other stuff, we at risk. And the president has acknowledged it. But there's a need for those three ministers, those principals, to find a way of coming together on these things. It can't be only the Minister of Finance, or only the Minister of Public Enterprises. Only the Minister of Minerals and Energy. It's a multiple principle issue. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And I think members, we have heard the advices. I'm not sure about the analysis about other committees previous years. Whether do we relate to those analysis, to those committees, I don't know. But sometimes it helps to get a constructive criticism. And sometimes it also, all the time it helps to look at you and think, with this being said, where do I stand? It helps a lot. And then, Prof, I think it's not a matter of POB wanting to work with you. I think on behalf of the committee, I'll take a risk this time around. I'm not an autocratic person, but I'll take a risk and say, as the chairperson of the committee, we'll expect you to work together with all the stakeholders to make sure that those conditions are going to serve the interests of the citizens, and there's value for money at the end of the day. And also the clarity that you have given, even though you were not direct, but I could get it through what you were saying, that we can't separate the condition from the bill first, because if we separate it, it will be like just one piece of paper. So with the necessary expertise
from Parliament and yourself will be able to develop that, and Treasury will help, and DPE will help in developing that. But you have had all what we have raised, and I want to thank you very much, Eskom, for being here. You have heard what you said, and also your contributions, your presence meant a lot to this committee. And I want to thank the members, FSC, PBO, for availing yourself. And together, let's take South Africa forward. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
This
will be outside the meeting.
Okay, that's fine. I just wanted to notify the members that I sent an email to Lubabalo that included all the PBO's previous work on Eskom, especially Honorable Vider, asked for more time series data, and our 2017 report on Eskom finances, many of the charts go back to the 1990s, to like 97, so you have some of that data. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the outside meeting conversation, and it will be distributed to all the members, not only you. I think we all need that information. Thank you.